Support for Boston Public Radio comes from M&M Skylights. Servicing Massachusetts and New Hampshire, their team is part of the Velux Skylight Specialist Network and is committed to helping improve the air quality in your home or business. You can learn more and schedule a consultation at mmskylights.com.
And Owens Corning of New England, helping homeowners create living space using the Owens Corning Basement Finishing System for over 20 years. More information at ocboston.com.
Today on Boston Public Radio, the Supreme Court saga continues. What was supposed to be smooth sailing for Trump and the GOP could turn into this year's October surprise. We'll talk to Meet the Press's Chuck Todd about the latest developments surrounding Kavanaugh's calamitous confirmation and other politics headlines. Then we open the lines and ask you, as messy as it's become, could the Kavanaugh allegations be a good thing for small d democracy and for big D Democrats?
At noon, former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral joins for this week's edition of Law and Order. And after crisscrossing the country on two national tours, Hamilton finally comes to Boston's Opera House. Does it live up to the hype? We'll ask WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen about that and other arts, culture events and controversies around town. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello there, Marjorie. So amid the mounting crises in the Trump White House, from the Supreme Court saga to the Mueller investigation and Manafort's flip, is it time for President Trump to trade in his Rolling Stones rally song, "You Can't Always Get What You Want," for 19th Nervous Breakdown? Joining us on the line to take on these and other headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Hey there, Chuck Todd.
How are we doing? Happy Thursday.
And to you.
To you, too. So, Senator Chuck Grassley has said that there needs to be a statement by 10 a.m. tomorrow from the accuser of would-be Justice Kavanaugh. If she doesn't produce a statement or her lawyers don't, then what happens? Do we have a hearing on Monday with just Kavanaugh sitting there?
You know, and this is the – look, on one hand, I think that Senator Grassley has made it clear he's willing to – he's given the appearance that he's willing to be flexible on how she testifies. But he's not showing flexibility on when she testifies.
Right.
And I think that that's, good on him for showing flexibility of how she testifies, public, not public, lawyers out to California, all those things. But I don't think they have a good explanation of why it has to be Monday or bust, right? Why can't it be another week? You know, I think Democrats that say, oh, it can go to the lame duck, they're playing games too, right? They're wanting to game the system and say, ooh, let's see if Democrats control the Senate. No. But there is not a good argument by anybody making the case of why. I mean, the best argument you can make is why this has to be done Monday is because you want a ninth justice on the court in time for opening day on the court in October. That's about the only case you can make on that. There's really – even this court operated obviously for a year with eight justices, so they've proven they can handle it just fine. What's wrong with mid-October?
You know, but Chuck, you say that's the only good argument. As we've learned, good arguments have nothing to do with anything. I want to get back to this.
Look, I actually try to look for a good argument. You know, you're right. It doesn't matter. It's the argument that works, good or bad.
Can we get back to Monday, though? Marjorie and I were talking before you gave us a buzz, and I'm trying to imagine the scenario. So if there is a hearing, and if Professor Ford has not submitted a statement, meaning she's not there, Kavanaugh's got to respond to something. Does Chuck Grassley read the Washington Post story out loud with the quotes? I mean, I'm serious. I mean, how does it work?
Do they put a chair with her face on it in the hearing room?
I don't think this hearing happens.
Oh, you don't?
I just don't think it happens. I mean, I don't think it's going to turn. I don't think the Republicans are going to create a spectacle like that. I think that that's playing with fire here, too. I think everybody's a little nervous about the politics of this, for what it's worth, left and right.
Yes.
You know, as we know, the culture wars you never know how they're going to break politically, okay? You just don't know who it fires up, who it doesn't fire up, and how this and the fights over the court have a way of uniting the Republican base in ways that nothing else has united them this year. So you just don't know how this is going to play out politically. But I have to tell you, I come back to trying to put myself in Judge Kavanaugh's shoes. So this is out there. Do you want this asterisk? Do you want to be, you know, how bad do you want to be in the court? Do you want this asterisk? If this were me, and I'm as innocent as he claims he is, then bring on the FBI investigation. Ask for it.
Is that still possible, do you think? I mean, we all remember just a few days ago, there was only going to be telephone interviews, and then a few hours later, there was a full-blown hearing.
The President of the United States can order a background, basically the reopening of the background check.
As they did on Anita Hill, right?
That's what this is. That's exactly what they did with Anita Hill. So you just open it up, and they talk to people involved, and they, you know, do the best that they can. It doesn't seem to be again, you know, it's funny. I've been thinking about Justice Thomas here and thinking about...
Me too.
Do we know for sure that he would be the justice that he is today had he not gone through... You know, it's possible that the reason he's the guy who never says a word is he decided after that experience he's going to lay low. Maybe the experience embittered him, right? And maybe he's let decisions impact him. The point is, we don't know if he would have been a different justice had the circumstances been different. Maybe he'd have been the most, the guy who spoke the most and when he listened to this stuff, depending on, you know what I mean? This, you can't tell me this isn't going to have an impact on how he acts as a justice. You can't tell me that the experience didn't have an impact. He's a human being. Human beings react normal. You know, it is okay to, you know, it happens, right? You react personally. I just think, and yet he's been on there with an asterisk, right? He's always had an asterisk for anybody that went through that. You've always had this weird asterisk next to Thomas, right? It was this weird moment, and everybody's been uncomfortable with how that went down. Does Judge Kavanaugh want that asterisk?
Yeah,
have it anyway, but I would want to at least, you know, I think if you get through a background, if you have the FBI reopen it and they get through the background check, I think it makes that, at least puts the asterisk in pencil.
Here's, when you talk about reacting personally, let me react a little bit, less as a journalist, but as a woman and a mother and a regular citizen. If they don't have a hearing, this is what the Republican Senate and the President of the United States is saying to me, that they have a man accused by all accounts, a very respectable, upstanding woman of attempted rape. And they don't care whether he did it or not. They're prepared to put the second sex offender, credibly accused sex offender, on the Supreme Court. And Clarence Thomas, in his almost saying nothing time on that court, has nonetheless ruled against women on reproductive rights, on equal pay issues, on their women's ability to sue for sexual harassment in the workplace. I mean, I can't be the only woman here who's beside herself over this.
Oh, and Marjorie, you're not going to be. And this is you just raised what I think is the politically the worst outcome for the Republicans is if they jam this through next week.
But they are,
right?
If they jam this through next week,
I don't know. I don't buy that they will. I know there's discomfort there. Look, this is one of those, and I know it's possible. If Kavanaugh withdraws, it helps the Republicans, and if they put it through, it helps the Democrats. I know that that's weirdly counterintuitive. No, picture scenario.
I agree
you're
completely.
Right. I think you're totally,
you know,
right.
where this would have that kind of political impact, you know, the ultimate Pyrrhic victory, particularly for the Republicans here. I think if they go through it this next week, and they've only basically, you know, they gave her a deadline of when she can, of how she comes. Goes about this, I just think it's going to then become an issue that rallies the left in a big way. And yet, if he withdraws, if Kavanaugh withdraws, it's very possible this unifies the Republican base in a way that we hadn't seen really since the 2 weeks before the presidential election.
Can we talk about a couple of the individuals for a second? Marjorie's favorite, and I mean that sarcastically, Senator Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Flake, Corker. Now, Corker, even though he's sort of part of the resistance in the Senate after wanting to be vice president before he was part of the resistance, Corker said, I guess it was yesterday, well, let's do Monday. I'm paraphrasing. If she doesn't show up, then he did say this, let's vote. So put him aside for a minute. The Flakes, the Murkowskis, the Collins, if they lose two of them and the Democrats hold, which I think is much more likely after the Professor Ford thing
too,
than it was
and
before.
I never would have said that 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah. Nor yeah. I. Do all those people end up voting for Kavanaugh, even though Professor Ford never had an opportunity on her terms, admittedly, to state her case before the American people?
You know, I don't. You know, it's interesting, and I'm going to go back to Thomas here, and this is where part of me says, I'm not as convinced he has the votes because of what you're saying. Remember, one of the reasons why Thomas got confirmed is that there was a slew of Southern Democratic senators at the time. Chuck Robb was in Virginia. You had Sam Nunn still in Georgia. In fact, two of them, Sam Nunn and Weish Fowler. You had Hal Heflin in Alabama. You had a whole slew of Southern Democrats who essentially got reelected based, you know, would at this point in time in the late 80s, early 90s, were winning on the backs of African-American voters. And there was a perception among Senate Democrats in the South that if they voted against Thomas, African-American voters would punish them for this. So he got confirmed thanks to Southern Democratic senators. Remember, Democrats had the majority.
Mm-hmm.
I think a similar – what I've been wondering is that is there going to be a similar fear factor among some Republican senators about women? You know, this gender gap keeps widening. You know, there's – you think, oh, geez, 12 points, 15 points, 20 points. I mean, at some point you would think the fear of the gender gap biting them in reelection would give them pause at railroading this through, or the perception that they're railroading it through. So that's why I am not convinced that a party line vote. I think there will be a couple senators that back off a party line vote. I do.
You know,
I think if this is headed for a party line, 51-49, we've never had a Supreme Court justice this way, and I just think it's a that is a – we have never – I don't think there's ever been a Supreme Court justice that did not get at least one vote from the other party. That would be, I think, a very, very, very bad precedent. I think there are enough Republican senators who would want to avoid that.
Hey, Chuck, can you stay with us for all 3 hours today, please? No, but can I do a follow-up to that just for 1 second, Marjorie?
Yeah.
One person you didn't – one Democrat you didn't name who I think also suffers in the wake of this Kavanaugh thing no matter what is Joe Biden. Biden,
yeah.
I believe, voted
1,000%.
No. But I had Jill Abramson on the other night, former executive editor of the New York Times, who, along with Jane Mayer, as you know, has written extensively about the hearing. She was there. They also believe Thomas has committed impeachable sexual offenses since he's been on the Supreme Court, not just from before. Joe Biden refused to call four women who would have been theoretically corroborating witnesses for Anita Hill. That rears its head again, regardless of what the Kavanaugh outcome is, if Joe Biden decides to put his foot in this pool, does it not?
It does. Look, I've thought there's two things. There's always been two moments that he's got to fix in his political career if he's going to be able to survive this Democratic electorate. One is Anita Hill, and the other is the crime bill of the mid-90s, which increased African-American incarceration levels to these highs that now – That frankly, people on both sides of the aisle have said turned out to be a mistake, but he was the champion of that. So he brings a ton of baggage on two specific issues that I think are front and center for a lot of Democratic voters. Right, one is the criminal justice system, and one is basically gender. You know, the issues important to women. And while yes, he has been the Violence Against Women Act is that Joe Biden championing that too. So he's got plenty in his background where he's been on the forefront. But yes, I think that he would be dealing his mid-90s record, starting in 91 with Anita Hill and going through the crime bill of 96. That would if he doesn't get the Democratic nomination, it'll be because of his votes in that 5-year period.
You know, then you've got the optics here of 85-year-old Chuck Grassley and Orrin Hatch, who I think is 84, on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Orrin Hatch, as we know, is waving a copy of The Exorcist back at the Anita Hill hearings, accusing her of plagiarizing and coming up with the pubic hair and the Coke can line from that. Now you've got Orrin Hatch, who seems to have learned nothing from the Me Too movement, in which almost everybody denies everything, just like Kavanaugh is denying everything, saying, well, I know Judge Kavanaugh, and I sure do believe him, but I don't know her, so I don't believe her. I mean, I can just imagine the heads popping off if these men show such ignorance in any kind of hearing on Monday.
That's why I think this hearing, I just never believed this hearing was going to happen. I think this hearing is so fraught with peril, more for Republicans than the Democrats, but for no women. And then they have this idea of having female staffers question her. And I'm just sitting there, so what you're going to do is bring more attention to the fact that you don't have women up there? And I'm sorry, these are elected officials. I understand if these were bureaucrats who'd, oh my God, having to question a woman at 85. These are elected officials. They have to win votes. They're out there talking to people. And we have to protect them from themselves? Oh, boy, don't let the old guy ask questions of women. Let's find another woman. Are you kidding me? Does that mean that any time an African-American's up there, you have to get an African-American to ask questions? Like, this is just – I don't understand why somebody thought that was a good idea and such a good idea. Let's leak it out. Well, okay, if this hearing happens. Really?
You know, Chuck Todd.
I mean, at least say to tell me this. Tell me you're going to bring Susan Collins and Deb Fisher to come question. At least they're United States senators. Okay? This idea of having a staffer, that's just, it's embarrassing.
You know, Chuck Todd, one last thing before you go. You know, they had all those secret sexual harassment settlements in the Congress, and where they we don't know who were the sexual harassers.
A lot of them with tax money, by the way.
Yes. Do we know if any of them are sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee or in the Senate they're going to be voting on Kavanaugh or not?
Here's what I can tell you. If there are, my guess is we're going to find out pretty soon, aren't we?
God, I hope so. Thank you.
Chuck, it's great to talk to you, as
so
always.
Much,
thanks
Chuck
for your time.
Chuck Todd.
Did you know about that thing he just mentioned at the end about the notion that women staffers might ask the question?
No, I didn't know. And that's why I'm so glad we have him on, because he knows a lot more than we do, and that's wonderful. Chuck Todd joins us every week, and we're so glad he does. He's moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of my second favorite show after Jim's, of course, Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC. And the political director for NBC News. So up next, we are opening the lines yet again, asking you about the latest developments surrounding the Kavanaugh confirmation. Listen to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The Republicans have an opportunity here to get to the truth in the Ford Kavanaugh charge and denial, to slow the entire process down, to do this right. And seeing that this is a pretty important appointment and that it's for life, why not do it right? It's questions forcing the GOP to do some serious calculations ahead of the midterms. The male-dominated party, by not taking Christine Blasey Ford's accusation against Kavanaugh seriously, could be penalized at the polls by alienating female voters. But off the latest developments, it looks like the GOP thinks pushing Kavanaugh onto the highest court is a risk worth taking. The chair of the committee, Chuck Grassley, has set a Friday morning deadline, as we said, for Christine Blasey Ford to decide if she'll testify on Monday. And even though he says he won't yield on the Monday date, he's offering her four options for testifying: an open hearing, a closed committee hearing, and either a public or a private question and answer by transcription. So we want to know, where are you on all this? At 877-301-8970. If you're a Republican, do you support the tactic? GOP women out there, could this affect your vote? And if Kavanaugh is not fully investigated, will questions about his legitimacy be a dark cloud over his tenure and over the tenure of those who choose to vote for him? You know, Marjorie, our number is 877-301-8970. Chuck just said to us a minute ago, he was quite sure that there has never been a Supreme Court nominee who's been confirmed without any votes from the other party. And our coworkers just double-checked. That is true. And this would be a first. And I think there were three Democrats, am I not right, from red states who voted for Neil Gorsuch? I think that's right. And regardless, I think it may be before the Ford charges, they might have broken party ranks and joined the Republicans. I think right now this is a straight party vote, unless some Republicans decide they're not going to do it. So do you think there's going to be a hearing? Chuck doesn't think there's even going to be a hearing. He also dropped into that conversation a couple of times, if Kavanaugh withdraws. We haven't talked about that much either. Is it possible that ultimately the Trump administration is going to decide that they want him to pull out of this thing and pick somebody else for whom they'll fight on another day? The number's 877-301-8970.
Yeah, and you can also tweet us at Boss Public Radio or Facebook at Boston Public Radio. Can we go to the calls?
Well, I just want to say a couple of things. I really do believe that the potential for this to be Year of the Woman on steroids, part two, could be really huge. Everybody knows now that the Year of the Woman in Congress was essentially a backlash, I guess you could say, to the Clarence Thomas hearings that everybody now knows. There went from 2 to 6 women in the Senate. The 4 additional women were all Democrats. I think the number was 47 women were elected in the House, 24 for the first time. So that was, excuse me, obviously very significant. And as I've mentioned to you guys virtually every day in the last week, the ABC Washington Post most recent poll on the generic congressional ballot, meaning no names, you're going to vote for a Democrat or a Republican, while there's a 10-point margin for overall for the Democrats, there's a 25-point margin amongst women, all women. And that's before this whole Kavanaugh thing broke. So I think the stakes here, in addition to a lifetime appointment or a lifetime confirmation of the Supreme Court, which is obviously huge, I think the implications come the midterms are even huger. 877-301-8970. Can you say one other thing that I was shocked by this morning as we were preparing for today's show? You read a piece, I think it was in the Washington Post, about the statute of limitations on actions like Professor Ford suggests were committed by Kavanaugh and this Mark Judge character?
Yes, a former U.S. attorney down there in Maryland said that if you bring someone with you, as Ford alleges Kavanaugh did, this judge character, into a attempted rape, which this is what she's accusing him of, there is no statute of limitations, which means that...
Well, that's a huge deal.
That is a huge deal, which means that essentially... Kavanaugh could be indicted, and tried. Now, it's very unlikely because this is a case from a long time ago, but that's really significant.
If that's true, then why aren't the law enforcement people in whatever county it's in, have they reached out to her? Apart from whether the FBI should investigate or not, have they reached out to her and say, we'd like to talk to you because there is no statute of limitations, and what you appear to be describing in your Washington Post interview and your lawyers are describing appears to fit that definition? Have we heard anything about that?
No, we have not heard anything about that. And I was stunned when I read that this morning. But that apparently a former U.S. attorney in Maryland should know about the law in Maryland. And that's what he's written. 877-301-8970. Let's start with Jay in Newton. Hi, Jay.
Hello, Jay. Welcome.
Hi. First time, long time. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for both those things. Welcome.
Sure. So I agree pretty much with everything that you've said, and I listen to a lot of the talking heads on the radio. And the only thing that I'm not really hearing or seeing is any of the moderate Republican senators who, in my opinion, need to put pressure either up front or behind the scenes with the leaders to say, hey, listen, if we don't have the, an FBI investigation, you cannot count on my vote. And I'm just wondering, I mean, we heard from Flake, he's really the only one that has kind of come out and kind of implied that, let's get this thing over with. But I'm curious as to your opinion as to, do you think that that's really the only recourse or the only leverage? Because we know we can't count on Trump to do the right thing. So to me, that's really the only chance that an FBI hearing is going to be open.
Well, and that was the issue I tried to raise with Chuck Todd. I find it hard to believe that 51 out of 51 Republicans, including a few who have been very critical of Trump in the past, including the two pro-choice women, are just going to fall into line if she never has an opportunity to tell her story. And keep in mind, Jay, she's not saying setting ridiculous terms. I want to repeat what I said to Chuck Todd for those who don't know the history, and I didn't remember it until I was doing a little research yesterday. This is not unprecedented. This is exactly what happened when Anita Hill came forward late in the hearings on Clarence Thomas. And one of the great ironies, talk about a different time. Do you know who decided the FBI should investigate the charges against Clarence Thomas, Jay from Newton? The president of the United States, who nominated Clarence Thomas, George H.W. Bush. And ultimately, they said the findings of the FBI cleared him.
And by the
way, what a different time.
At the Anita Hill hearings, Orrin Hatch went on and on about how the president had done the right thing by bringing in this investigation.
Oh, I didn't remember that. Is that so?
Now he's saying the exact opposite.
So, Jay, the long-winded answer to your much more focused question than my response is I do hold out hope that there are people of principle in the Republican Party, even if they ultimately end up voting for Kavanaugh because they believe him, who will say we should postpone this thing because getting to the truth is more important to getting to an outcome fast. So, Jay, thanks for listening and for your first call, and please do it again. 877-301-8970.
You know, it is just incredible when you think about what the president and his Republican enablers are trying to do here. They're trying to rush through the appointment to the Supreme Court for life of the second credibly accused sex offender, first being Clarence Thomas, who, in case people don't know, was accused by Anita Hill, but since then has been accused by multiple other women, and including a rear-end squeezing
while he was on the court, a sitting
justice. And there were also four of the women who could have corroborated her story who were never there. So we have multiple people who've accused Clarence Thomas. We have one person right now accusing Kavanaugh, although The Intercept has just reported some news about other people alleging things involving Brett Kavanaugh, but I have to read through it before I go any further with that. But the point is, why, you know, I understand the Republicans' political needs to rush this, but that's basically what they're doing. They're basically saying, we have to rush this.
Yeah, but you're saying, I understand their political needs, but why but? This is what they campaigned. This campaign, a huge part of the Trump campaign, other than Trump himself, was we're going to change this court. We are going to create a court that will repeal Roe v. Wade, that will change this country for decades.
But I think it's problematic.
They are one vote away from getting there.
But I think it's very problematic for most fair-minded Americans to change the court with someone who has been accused of what he's been accused of without an investigation. To at least
Was there an investigation of Donald Trump? I can't remember.
No, there isn't, and that's
They voted for him, didn't they? So the answer is maybe you're misreading the
public. They voted for him. I've said this a million times before the Me Too movement.
Well,
has been historical in the United States of America that we don't believe sex crime victims. We just don't believe them. We've begun to believe them little bit more, although we're still seeing massive disbelief of Ms. Ford. But we have since the Me Too movement, and you know why? Because these guys all do exactly what Kavanaugh's done. They all deny everything. Clarence Thomas denied everything. Bill Cosby denied everything. Bill Clinton denied everything. Bill O'Reilly denied everything. Roy Moore denied everything. They all deny everything. And they've got...
Well, Bill Clinton didn't deny everything forever.
Well, he didn't deny everything forever, but he did for a long time. So, again, I think that you begin to say to yourself, gee... Who's really lying here?
Sherry and Lunenberg, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. This is my first call.
Ooh.
I'm calling because, as Marjorie was just talking about, was how everybody denies. Susan Collins this morning was talking about how emphatically he denies what he did or didn't do or whatever. But I just want to know, when was the first time somebody said, yeah, that was me. I did
exactly.
That. I was a sex offender.
That's right.
You know, that never happens. And I'm not saying he did it or didn't do it. I would like to try and keep an open mind about it. However, when everybody else seems to think, well, he's so emphatic, how could he possibly have done this? You know, come on.
Do you remember Clarence Thomas in the hearings, how he got up there in this
indignant voice and called everything. You know what he did too,
high-tech luncheon,
which is very interesting, which I realized when I reread the transcript. Anita Hill listened to, followed the hearings. When Clarence Thomas was asked if he'd listened to Anita Hill's testimony, he said no. He was, why would she listen to any more lies? And then he got up there and unequivocally denied everything. And as we now know, I think it's fairly clear, Sherry, we know who was lying in that instance, and it wasn't Anita Hill.
Sherry, just before you go, just to get Marjorie more aggravated with Senator Collins than she already is,
oh,
when Senator Collins was saying that Judge Kavanaugh emphatically denied the charges, did she also say that Professor Ford emphatically supports her own story, or no?
Well, I heard this on a clip here, so no, I did not hear her say anything of that nature.
Well, I think it's a major, big, big, big moment in the career of Susan Collins. And I think how she behaves here is how she will be judged by history. Sherry, another good first call. Make one again. You too. Thank you.
You know, there's a front page story in the Boston Globe this morning about Republicans risk angering women in the Kavanaugh case. I guess I'm exhibit A on that one. But they have a quote in here from Senator Collins from a radio station interview yesterday where she says that Kavanaugh's lawyers should be allowed to question Ford and vice versa, setting up what the Globe calls a potentially intimidating courtroom-like setting. Here's the quote from Collins. I think it's not fair to Judge Kavanaugh for her not to come forward and testify, saying then that the allegations would hang over Kavanaugh's head.
Right. And the answer, Senator Collins, is she's more than willing to come and testify as long as you do an FBI investigation, just like President Bush the First ordered in the Clarence Thomas case. End of discussion. John in Bristol, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Good morning, folks. I just have a question, actually a comment about Chuck Todd's remarks with respect to if Kavanaugh walks away, it would help the Republican base and hurt the Democrats. I kind of disagree with that a little bit with respect to the fact that if Kavanaugh did walk away, my opinion, I hope more opinions would agree with this, it's an admission of guilt or fear of guilt with respect to what he has done. And he doesn't want that to further impact where he is in life. Because if, in fact, he did do that, it not only hurts his case of becoming Supreme Court Justice, it hurts who he is in current day life. So I think that's something that needs to be thought about if he does walk away.
Well, John, I tend to agree with you, except if he did walk away, you know what he would say. I'm not saying it'd be convincing. He would say, I want to start by reiterating, I have never done anything like what Professor Ford suggests I did to her. Never would, never have. But frankly, what matters more to me than a seat on the Supreme Court is my family and, you know, on and on like this. And so for the good of my family and maybe even says for the good of the country, because screaming at each other is not terribly healthy, he steps out. But I agree with you. The conventional wisdom will be that he's a guilty man. So you actually may have something there. John, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970.
You know, I think everybody knows, but it's worth repeating that since these charges have been public and the woman's name, Christine Blasey Ford, has been made public, she's received multiple death threats and had to move out of her house and is living separately mm-hmm. with her children. And her email has been hacked and people have impersonated her online, and et cetera. So it does. Anita Hill didn't have that long to prepare for her testimony either. But this is an extraordinary situation for Ms. Ford. You're thinking, what about my children if I go ahead? What about my ever going back to my normal life if I go ahead? We all remember the pictures of Anita Hill just being mobbed mm-hmm. By reporters and photographers and protesters after her testimony.
Well, add one thing. If I can just quote myself yesterday, for those who question her credibility, I think the strongest support for her credibility is that she's the one who's calling for an FBI investigation.
Right.
Speaking personally, if I was making up a story about anything, the last thing I would do if I had a choice between just testifying and perpetuating the lie or having the FBI investigate what I say is true but I know is a lie is calling the FBI. She's the one who wants the FBI to look into the underlying facts. If anything underscores her credibility, in my opinion, it's that.
And so does the fact that she said there was a second person in the
right.
room.
That's a very
And they're not even bothering to interview the second person in the room. Now,
did you hear Wendy Murphy make that point last night on CNN?
No, I did not.
Our buddy Wendy Murphy made the exact same point.
Now, it's not surprising that he can't remember this because he wrote an entire book about how he spent much of his high school and college career blacked out.
That's Judge we're talking about, not Judge Kavanaugh.
Yes, and unable to remember almost anything. So what he can't remember isn't that surprising. But, you know, it's not that hard to do an investigation. Many people have pointed out it's not that time consuming. You talk to Judge, you talk to Kavanaugh, you talk to Ford. You try to get some idea of who else might have been at this party, who their circle of friends were in high school. There was a woman who posted on Facebook, a classmate of Ford's, who said she heard rumors about this incident in school. She then was, of course, mobbed by those of us in the media, and that's what we do, go out and try to get interviews with someone who says
something
like this.
And she stepped back
She stepped back and said she did not know, she had no firsthand knowledge of whether this incident happened, but she did know that there were rumors about the incident at her school. You've had other people, an extremely eloquent friend of hers was on television last night talking about her credibility, her professional excellence, et cetera. And the woman was really an impressive witness. You could have
there are a lot of women vouching for Kavanaugh, too. What is it? Is it 65 or
yes,
some large,
exactly. So she's a very credible person, and it's not. You know, you ask yourself, someone who's in her 50s, mother, professor, with a great career, a great life, big surfer apparently, goes down to the waves at Santa Cruz all the time.
Whatever that has to do with
anything. Well, just that she's a well-rounded, normal person, but very credible. Why would you make this up?
By the way, there are reports of multiple victims in a shooting at a Rite Aid distribution center in Baltimore. There is a media briefing scheduled at 11:45, and we'll obviously keep you abreast of that.
Okay, we are talking about what else? The Kavanaugh hearings, what's going to happen. We're going to keep talking about that till the top of the hour. Our number is 877-301-8970. You can tweet us at Boss Public Radio or email us at bpr@wgbh.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation process, going over the latest developments, and asking if you support the GOP's push to get him onto the court, even if there is no FBI investigation, as Professor Ford is seeking, and as the Republicans say there will not be, should the Senate Judiciary Committee do due diligence and thoroughly investigate Ford's accusations against him, or just move ahead next week. 877-301-8970. You know, one thing I also don't understand, am I right in saying Chuck Todd said to us a few minutes ago, he doesn't think there is going to be a hearing. And so,
he does not.
So if there, one, I don't understand how a hearing works if there is one, as I say, because who presents her side to which Kavanaugh would respond, which would argue there won't be a hearing. And if there's not a hearing, how do Republican senators get up and say, I am convinced that Brett Kavanaugh didn't do this when, one, she never got to testify, and two, he never got to publicly testify saying he didn't do it. He just told them individually, like he told a lot of them, or he's quoted in the newspapers. How does that even work?
Well, I guess the basic message is that we've crossed a new threshold, that when you have a president of the United States who's been credibly accused by almost 20 women of sexual harassment, including a bunch of teenage girls at a beauty pageant, that, you know, what the hell? Why not have another accused sexual harasser on the Supreme Court? That's basically the message of what they think about women's claims about sexual harassment. And by the way,
they need to get 50 out of 50. If they're no Dems, they need to get 50 out of 51 Republicans, all but one. And then the tie can be broken by Mike Pence, who's the president of the Senate. Is that possible that only one Republican, if that, would break ranks? Maybe not even saying I think Kavanaugh's guilty, but that I can't vote yes on his nomination without a thorough investigation having done by the FBI. There aren't two Republicans willing to do that? I mean, that is really, it's hard for me to believe.
Okay, here's Art from the other side.
Yep.
When I was just talking about Christine Blasey Ford. He says, just a normal, well-rounded woman suffering from Trump derangement syndrome who figures that since it's he said, she said from 30 years ago, and the FBI won't be able to prove or disprove it, there's no downside to calling for an FBI investigation.
Well, a lot of people believe that. I think a lot of people believe
that. The downside, Art, is that her life is never going to be the same. She's had to move out of her house. She's had to hire private security. She can't live with her children. They're afraid to go to school, carrying on with their life. And she's got, these white supremacist website people trolling her and torturing her. So that's the downside.
Nancy and Ashford, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
Hi, guys. First of all, you've got to start remembering me. I'm a frequent caller.
Hello again.
My feelings are hurt.
Hello again, Nancy. How's that?
Thank you. That's good.
Okay.
I think what needs to be repeated over and over, something people have been skirting around and saying indirectly, who has the greatest incentive to lie?
Who does?
Obviously, Kavanaugh. Anybody that looks at it should be able to see the negative consequences on Ford and what Kavanaugh is trying to defend. And if we just keep saying over and over, who has the greater incentive to lie? It's what a friend of mine said. It's been in the New York Times, so I can't take credit for it. But who has the greater incentive to lie?
Now, Nancy, before you go, I want you to listen to this carefully. Thank you for calling again, Nancy. Is that okay?
Ooh. I made you feel guilty.
Nancy, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
You know,
sure, you're welcome.
I mentioned to Jim this morning that there's a great story in the Washington Post. I don't know if the timing was intentional or not, talking about the rape of a 16-year-old
yeah.
in a high school in Texas. And it gives some understanding of the dynamics of these kind of cases where, once again, it was the victim that was put on trial and basically driven out of town on a rail with just gross attacks on her. That's what happens. I don't know what the dynamic is, but for some reason, we are incredibly hostile towards women who accuse men of sex crimes. We just don't want to acknowledge it. We don't want to admit it. And we think that we can look at men and see which ones are guilty of this kind of thing. I have heard a million times, well, I know Clarence Thomas. He couldn't do this. People said Roger Ailes at Fox, all these women said, I've worked with Roger Ailes for years. He's never done anything like this. It's as if they don't learn anything from the priests. You know, oh, my goodness, Father Gagin was a wonderful guy. He was a wonderful pastor at St. Julia's Parish. How could he possibly, he looked like a little Irish elf. How could he possibly have raped dozens and dozens of little boys and little girls? We don't learn anything. And we never ask ourselves, why are we so hostile? You know, why is Art accusing this woman of being guilty of Trump derangement syndrome? If that were the case, Art, I should be saying that Kavanaugh attacked me on a surfboard out in Santa Cruz.
You know, and also I want to reiterate the point you've made ad nauseum, but it is incredibly important, again, even though it's been made a lot of times, primarily by you, is there's no other alleged crime.
No other alleged crime
where the first place that a significant part of the population goes to is
the accuser is lying.
I know,
exactly.
It's just, there's no question about that.
My classic example, if 10 different clerks at 7-Eleven said Jim Browdy came in and robbed them at the counter, 10 different people said this, Jim Browdy would be hauled into Suffolk Superior Court, or in your case, I guess Middlesex Superior Court, mm-hmm. and charged with crimes. But if 10 women who don't even know each other say the same things about men, in the Les Moonves case, that he grabbed my head and shoved it into his crotch, I don't think Les Moonves would have survived for all these years as the head of a Fortune 500 company making $69 million a year and now hoping he's going to get a $100 million golden kiss on the way out the door.
Stephen in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Oh, patience I have, especially for you guys.
Thank you very much.
I remember Anita Hill, and I remember Clarence Thomas. And one of the only good things about remembering back to 91 and before that is you can also remember things from Emily Dickinson, who talked about small things in rather small poems that might have seemed childish if they weren't so right on in terms of the truth and in terms of a savage demand for the truth. And one of the things that bothered me when I watch Judge Kavanaugh on television, and this is a little thing, but I urge people to look at these little things. There was a pregnant moment. There was a moment. There was a lot of disruptions in the room. But there was a man, I forget exactly who it was, who came up very bravely and extended his hand towards that man of great privilege and, I think, of great hubris. He would get into any social club to which he applied, I guarantee. I wouldn't write a letter. But the thing is that he looked at that man with a sense, a visible sense of shock and horror, and he turned from that man.
Do you know who the man was, Stephen?
Yes, his son. He had lost a child.
Was killed.
Was killed, yes. And for me, it was a pregnant moment, because when I watch someone who has had an extraordinary privileged life turn away, I have a sense of Emily Dickinson's certain slant of light, and it's not an attractive, pretty slant of light. It would have shown me that he had an openness, that he was willingness right there and then to listen.
Can I just say, in all, I happen to be with you. By the way, the guy's name was, I can't remember his first name, Gutenberg. His kid was killed in Parkland. His daughter, not his son, I think.
Yes, that's
but,
right.
But in fairness to Kavanaugh, when he finally responded to questions recently about the issue you raised, his contention, I'm not vouching for it, I'm just repeating it, is that he thought that the man who was seeking to shake his hand was a protester. He said that if he had... I'm not vouching for him, just saying it. Had he known that Gutenberg was the father of a shooting victim at Parkland, he says he would have shaken his hand. But Stephen, thank you for bringing Emily Dickinson
to
the...
May I just say one thing, Jim?
Real quick.
I think when we see people who have a generosity of spirit and an openness, and they're willing to look at, understand, and confront, I want that person, man or woman, on that court.
That's a great point.
Stephen, thanks.
That's a great point, Stephen.
Plus, the Dickinson reference made you happy, so that was a twofer kind of call.
Let's go to Tim in Newton. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Tim.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. Awesome show, as always.
Sure. Thanks.
The caller just before made a really great point. That moment just, it really stuck with me. And no matter who the person was, no matter what it was like in the courtroom, just that look on his face, it just bugged me. But I think that what's become apparent is that there needs to be a third party, in my opinion. There has to be a legitimate third party. When senators on the right know that, they know in their heart of hearts they do not want to vote for this man, but they have to. They don't have a choice. In the same way, nobody wanted to vote for Hillary and nobody wanted to vote for Donald, but we had to make a choice. There's got to be no choice.
Oh, Tim, we're losing you.
Yeah, it's a bad connection.
What Tim said in the second half of the call is that when nobody really wanted to vote for Hillary Clinton or for Donald Trump, and for those who don't remember that, I know that there are people who are offended who like Trump or like Clinton. As we've said only 10,000 times, they were the two least popular candidates in the history of polling in American presidential elections, with Hillary Clinton being a little less disliked than Donald Trump was in those polls.
Jake from Beverly. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Jake.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I believe Dr. Ford, and I think she's a very credible accuser. I just don't understand why she won't testify on Monday. I don't see what she has to lose. Definitely an FBI investigation would be the better alternative, but I think if she doesn't testify, it makes it very easy for Republican senators to say, well, you know, she wouldn't come and defend what she said. She wouldn't defend her accusations. Without any more information, I'm going to vote for Kavanaugh.
By the way, I think I completely agree with the second half of what you're saying. That's what it allows them to say. What her lawyers have said are two things. One, that she needs more time to prepare. It's not just like you go tell your story. You're going to be shredded or attempted to be shredded
Kavanaugh
by the Republican senators.
Has not only coached for weeks for his hearings, he has been nonstop coached in the White House in these recent days.
Well, he's also had other confirmation hearings, so he's experienced this before.
And plus, he's a judge.
Plus,
so he's got her like 100-1 in terms of experience.
And the second thing, I think you make a very decent point about the political impact, at least short-term impact, is without an independent third law enforcement voice like the FBI, it is likely to end up with a he said, she said kind of thing. And I guess her position, I surely don't want to speak for her, but I assume this is a fair statement, is that she believes having an independent voice who actually investigates since she says she's telling the truth, will help cause the balance to be in her direction. Having said that, I agree, if there's a hearing, and Chuck Todd doesn't think there will be a hearing, if there's a hearing and Kavanaugh is the only one there, it's easy for the Grassleys and others to say, we asked her to come, we wanted her to come, we provided a forum, she refused. Now, obviously, the Democrats will respond to that, but that is what they'll say.
But the third thing is, to me, is the risk of the degradation and humiliation she could endure at the hands of, in a couple of cases at least, very elderly men who don't know anything about sexual harassment or sexual violence, who are stuck back in the kind of 1920s and will ask, who knows? I mean, Orrin Hatch has already said totally inappropriate things, and he disgraced himself at the Anita Hill hearings, and it doesn't seem he's grown in his knowledge of the subject matter in 27 years.
Jake, thanks for the call. Diana, we only have a minute left. It's yours. Welcome.
Hi. I just want to point out there is no statute of limitation in the state of Maryland, and the prosecutor, a prosecutor there, is inviting her. I think she should threaten to press charges against him for attempted rape if they don't allow the FBI investigation.
Well, Marjorie mentioned earlier that the lack of a statute of limitations on this kind of case. What you added, which I was not aware of, is that the prosecutor has actually invited her to come in. Assuming that's true, it's a pretty important development. Thanks for sharing it with us, Diana. We appreciate your time. We'll obviously stay on top of this throughout the day, as will our colleagues after we are done at 2 o'clock. 10 o'clock is the deadline tomorrow, according to Chairman Grassley, for her to agree to testify, to submit written testimony, without which he says she will not come on Monday. Will there actually be a hearing? There are a lot of questions yet to be resolved with what is it? It's today, Thursday, and obviously
today's
Mondays
Thursday.
Are far, far way away.
That is right. Who knows what could happen between now and Monday. But coming up, we're going to talk to former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral for a segment of Law and Order. We'll talk to her a little bit about the Kavanaugh case, but we'll also talk about an incredible story about the Red Sox banner.
This is the best. The best.
Mysteriously disappearing and then equally mysteriously being found, as well as quite a story about an inmate artist and his photographs of, not photographs, his paintings of golf courses. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, the top official at ICE is doubling down on his comments that the immigration detention centers are like summer camps. Even though there is reporting they're unusually cold, there have been documented instances of abuse, and the American Academy of Pediatrics says detention can cause psychological trauma and long-term mental health risks. We'll talk to Andrew Cabral about this and more on today's edition of Law and Order.
WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen is here with a take on Hamilton and the latest arts and a culture controversy around town. Then we talk to Mark Leibovich, known for his coverage of politics for the New York Times. He thought he was making a departure by writing about the NFL. But it turns out football is as clubby and swampy as D.C., His book is loaded with great gossip and details, so stick around to find out why Bob Kraft really loves eating organic eggs. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio.
I am Marjorie Egan because she just walked in the studio. Marjorie Egan.
And welcome to the second hour of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Joining us online. Hi, Marjorie. How are you? Joining us online for another edition of Law & Order is Andrew Cabral. Andrew is the former Suffolk County Sheriff and the former Secretary of Public Safety and the current CEO of Ascend. Andrew Cabral, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you both.
Andrea, we have just spent about 40 minutes talking with listeners, well, actually almost an hour, because we talked to Chuck Todd about the Kavanaugh case. We wanted to get your quick 2 cents before we move on to other law and order topics. What do you make of it?
I think it's insane that we're in a position where the United States Senate is forcing a confirmation process, rushing and hurrying a confirmation process, in the face of negative information about the nominee, which ordinarily would be the subject of an FBI investigation by way of a background check, that they're rushing this process not just in the face of that, but in the face of the actual person who alleges to have been victimized by this nominee calling for the FBI's intervention. And they're just ignoring all of it and demanding that she come before them. They won't interview any other witnesses. They want it to be what they keep calling a he said, she said, which bothers me tremendously, that phraseology for that. They want to be in the position of being able to say they can discount her testimony before them. And it's a shameful low point. We keep saying that this is a low point, that's a low point. This is yet another low point for the legislative branch in the way that they deal with Donald Trump's nominees to the judiciary.
Why do you object to that? I just said she said, he said myself a couple of minutes ago. So if I am going to be chastened, I want to know why. What, that is what it becomes if it essentially is her word against his without an independent investigation, isn't it?
Well, A, it should be she said, he said, because she's the one that's coming forward
right, of course,
with this information.
Yeah.
So the he said, she said part is sort of it evokes the real balance of power versus what is actually happening. So I think that's part of why it bothers me. But they can't credibly call it a search for the truth if they limit the information that they're willing to consider in order to find that. No investigation does that, not a criminal investigation, not a civil trial, not any proceeding where the truth inside of or outside of court, where the truth is supposed to be the end game, ever cuts off the amount of information that the fact finder can have before herself or himself to reasonably conclude where the truth lies. And that's exactly what they're doing.
So we're talking
about rigging it. They're essentially rigging the process.
We're talking to Andrew Cabral. Can we move just from the sublime to the ridiculous? I have to say, I've been doing this for 20 years.
Or the horrific to the ridiculous.
There are some great sound bites. This one might be in the top 10 ever. There are two Malden guys, Louis, I hope I pronounce that, Iacuzzi, and James Amaral, who yesterday were saying there's been a little change in the story. They hope to receive some sort of compensation from the Red Sox, maybe a ticket or two, maybe meet a player or two, because on the McGrath Highway, they're just driving along, and they happen to find the 2018 Red Sox division title banner. They haven't won the championship yet in the division, but they're about to today or tomorrow, whatever. Here is what the two of them, Louie and James, a part of what they had to say yesterday.
We're hoping they do the right thing. Yep. You know, we did the right thing. We could have kept it. We could have put it on eBay. We could have, you know, we got connections where we could have reached out to other sources. We're big supporters of the Red Sox.
And we want to see them win, and we want this banner to go back on Lansdowne Street or wherever it belongs.
And James Amaral went on to say, we're working too. I mean, my man had to run across three lanes of traffic to get this thing. Well, it turns out that their desire to be compensated for their wonderful act of public spiritedness has dissipated a bit. Apparently, they returned it. Now, as someone who's been in the criminal justice field for a long time, how credible did you find their story that it fell off a truck on the McGrath Highway?
Fell off a truck.
There, Andrew Cabral.
Yeah. I tend to think that's that's a little suspicious. I mean, also the, you know, they're driving on McGrath O'Brien Highway and pull over and run across three lanes of traffic to retrieve this thing without being hit. I mean, anybody who's been on McGrath O'Brien Highway knows that that is at best a risky proposition. So I don't know exactly where this banner came from, but as a former prosecutor, I would be looking for the exact area that they said that they retrieved it from, and I would be looking at any businesses or any public surveillance cameras, and I'd be getting the footage. That would be my first go-to to see whether or not, based on the story they're telling, that that actually happened in that time and in that space as they've described it. But, it, you know, the Red Sox are probably not overly interested in that because the situation has been resolved. But that was my reaction as a prosecutor to it.
You know, we rarely do this, but I think the sound is so fine. Do you mind, Marjorie, if we listen to it just
again.
One more time?
Absolutely.
This is Louis Iacuzzi. Because we'll never get to hear to quite like this. And James Amaral, what?
By the way, one quick thing, too, that's so crazy about them running across the three lanes of traffic. They didn't even know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what it was. It was just something that people supposedly were swerving to avoid. I think any one of us, who among us, Andrea, has not seen some odd thing in the roadway.
Stop the car.
And
run across three lanes.
Exactly. I do that every day.
So here is Iacuzzi and Amaral just one more time. Here they are.
We're hoping they do the right thing.
Yep.
You know, we did the right thing. We could have kept it. We could have put it on eBay. We could have, you know, we got connections where we could have reached out to other sources. We're big supporters of the Red Sox.
And we want to see them win, and we want this banner to go back on Lansdowne Street or wherever it belongs.
You know, the beauty of the, I love, every line is great. We could have put it on eBay. We got connections. We know people. It's just, it's almost like a movie,
right.
Essentially, in any case.
No, it's awful. I mean, they really, honestly, you know, the whole thing is just, you know, it's pretty bad. It's sort of like saying, you know, hey, I found your car with the keys in it in a part of town I'm not going to tell you about, and I want to do the right thing, but if you want to get your car back, you know, you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to pony up some money. I don't know how they thought they were going to get away with this. That's the... You know, they're dealing with the Red Sox organization, and I just don't know how they thought publicly saying something like, look, if they try to put up a second banner, you better believe we're going to be out there holding up the original to tell people it's not the original banner. And I'm thinking, to what end? Like,
by the way,
exactly do you think would be accomplished?
There's some breaking news. Associated Press is reporting that Chuck Grassley has ordered an FBI investigation of the banner stealing from the Red Sox. So as soon as they complete that, there
got
will be.
Got me all excited.
I knew.
There.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral.
I know, really. I thought you were going to say something real.
So did I.
Well, there may be. I don't think this story is over yet in terms of
but
Kavanaugh.
But Andrea, I want you to know one of our regular emailers, Robert, just emailed to say he would love to see Andrea Cabral questioning Judge Kavanaugh. So there you go. Vote of support from Robert.
So I would love to do
I
that
bet you
myself.
Would. So, Andrew Cabral, people may recall that Yarmouth police officer Sean Gannon and Auburn officer Ronald Tarantino were both killed in the line of duty by people who had very long criminal records. I think this is what is behind Governor Baker's legislation that would revamp the so-called dangerousness statute, which allows judges to keep criminal defendants awaiting trial behind bars if they are deemed to be dangerous to the community.
That was initiated by Bill Weld, was it not?
By Bill Weld after a guy who got out of prison, went out to California and killed this young couple. I remember that. There was a big uproar over that case. But anyway, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see what the bill looks like by the time it gets through the House and the Senate. If it gets to the House and Senate and the conference committee, what things are added, what things are taken out. You know, essentially, I agree with the idea that prosecutors should be able to hold a dangerousness hearing at any point during the process.
So
the way
I.
the statute was originally, the way it exists now and the way it was originally written was that, you know, you had to do it at arraignment. And quite frankly, at arraignment is the point in the proceeding at which you may know a lot about a particular crime or a particular defendant, but it's the least you'll know, usually, given what you know by the end of a proceeding. So it makes sense to be able to do it at any point. The concern that I have is, I think the story's wrong in terms of saying that for the first time under this bill, judges would be able to consider a criminal history. Judges have always been able to consider a person's criminal history in a dangerousness hearing. I'm not quite sure why the story says that. But the thing that concerns me is, I understand why Governor Baker is sort of couching this in terms of the deaths of police officers. But those are the kind of visceral, you know, they say hard cases make bad law. If you're going to revamp the dangerousness law, you can't have people having sort of a visceral reaction to the deaths of police officers. And the fact that he's included assault and battery on a police officer, which is a felony, as one of the crimes that can be considered, troubles me because people get charged with assault and battery on a police officer for shoving a police officer or allegedly shoving a police officer. So I worry about that as being a trigger for a dangerousness hearing. I think what I would have preferred is if the legislation had included, as David Nathanson says, some backup data. Look at the data first. See how frequently the dangerousness statute is being used by prosecutors currently, what kinds of crimes are most used to trigger a dangerousness hearing. See what the data tells you and let the data, because the numbers will lead you to the places that, you know, really are going to enhance public safety. And I don't know that there was any data sort of backing this up. And I always worry when the genesis of a bill, even if it contains some common sense provisions and some parts of it are reasonable, if part of the genesis of a bill is an emotional reaction to a tragic event versus a more careful and critically thought out reaction to an overall pattern in the courts or an overall need in public safety. That sort of troubles me. So I wish that had been done.
Yeah, Andrea,
there are parts of the bill that I agree with.
Andrea, you were used to do domestic violence stuff when you were a Suffolk County prosecutor. One of the areas it seems to me where there need to be, and this is just you more know more than I do, dangerousness hearings is in domestic violence cases, because we all remember that terrible case, Jared Remy's son, that's yeah. right, who had beaten and attacked several girlfriends before he ultimately killed the mother of his child. He had a long history. And in a lot of these domestic violence cases, you know, the guy goes in post-bail and he's right back out again. And you've got a woman who is back cowering in the apartment somewhere or in hiding.
Well, what you know, violation of a restraining order is one of the specifically enumerated crimes under the current 58A that can trigger a dangerousness hearing. Sometimes, you know, in that particular case, I think there was some miscommunication or some kind of an issue that didn't trigger it in Remy's particular case. But that is available. That's what I mean when I say the data. Look and see. You know, there is information out there to let you know exactly how frequently this statute is currently being used and for what crimes, so you can sort of figure out whether it's underused or overused. And if you're gonna file legislation to enhance it, maybe there are things you learn from the data that cause you to pull back on some of its current provisions. It's difficult because we want the criminal justice system to constantly be right. And the other thing that goes missing in a lot of these things, we use legislation as a talisman against our fears of what will happen to us in terms of being victims of a crime. And that's just not possible. There is a weighing of risk in every single thing the criminal justice system does. There are ways to mitigate that risk, but people have to accept that there are sometimes not going to be adequate reasons to seek a particular remedy, especially one like this, which requires a specific finding that there are no conditions, none, short of incarceration, that will protect the public from this particular person. That's kind of a high standard for a judge to have to make a finding on. Sometimes that risk is going to exist, and sometimes people are going to act on that, and terrible things are going to happen. I just want us to be careful about not legislating from a more visceral place.
Yeah, I have a few things for you on this, but before I do, just for a piece of history, didn't Jared Remy from prison prior to conviction write to you? Did he not?
Yeah, he did.
In a fairly threatening way, did he not?
Marjorie?
To Marjorie,
yes,
yeah, didn't he?
I forget what he said. I don't think it was a nice letter.
Yeah, in any case, I have a couple of things for you, though. When you talk, for example, your concern, Andrew Cabral, about including it in terms of the criteria for a dangerousness hearing to be initiated, assault and battery on a police officer, and sometimes assault and battery is, I know you don't mean minor like it's nothing, but it's not, you know, pushing as opposed to what we would ordinarily consider assault and battery. Having a right to have a dangerousness hearing doesn't mean that a judge is required to hold the person. It just means that it triggers the ability to have one. And if the underlying offense that caused the dangerousness hearing to be had is one that someone might argue was as minor as, and I use the term minor in quotes so you don't send me angry emails out there, is pushing a police officer rather than punching him or her or that sort of thing, then a judge would say, I deny the request to hold him. Isn't that what's likely to happen?
Right, and prosecutors will make a decision based on the enumerated facts of the particular felony. I'm cautious around things like this. And I'm cautious whenever we expand the law to include, it doesn't mean that I ultimately think that it ought not to be expanded. I'm just cautious in my approach to it. And what I was saying is that the cumulative effect of the tragic deaths of these police officers being so prominently considered in expanding this law, which generally, and this law applies well beyond things that result in the death of police officers, I'm just urging, I always urge caution when you have the power through legislation to drastically change a particular thing in the criminal justice system.
Can I just say one last thing here? I just fear, as we're having this long discussion about a really important topic, that a lot of people may not even understand the underlying thing. Please correct me if I'm wrong in this 20-second summary. Prior to this dangerousness hearing legislation filed by Governor Weld, the only criterion for holding on the part of a judge was the likelihood of returning to court on their court date, right? Is that not – and this expanded the breadth of things that a judge could consider when he or she was deciding whether to hold somebody. That was the genesis of this, right?
Yes, that's essentially true.
Okay.
The you could consider other factors, but it was basically about whether or not a defendant would return to court versus whether or not, if they were released, they pose a danger to the community if released.
Great. We're talking to Andrew Cabral, former sheriff of Suffolk County, former secretary of public safety.
Well, let's go to now a horrible story with a happy ending. Tell us about this Valentino Dixon, whose life sentence, a 39-to-life sentence for murder, was overturned after he started drawing pictures of golf courses.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating story, and it was none other than Golf Digest.
I know,
yes.
It's unbelievable.
That actually, you know, sort of pulled a lot of things together, and ultimately it was a lot of really good work by a lot of other people as well, that resulted in a guy who had been convicted of murder when he was 21, I think, in the early 90s. And had gotten a 39-year-to-life sentence,
right,
resulted in him ultimately being released. I mean, he's a tremendous artist, and he, even though he's never played the game, his name is Valentino Dixon. He's never played the game of golf, but he was always fascinated by the tranquility and the layout and the architecture of golf courses. He drew them, and a warden, he was sentenced to Attica, which is a notorious prison. And a warden who golfs asked him to draw a golf course. I think that he probably had a photograph. I think he draws them from photographs. And liked it very, very much. And this Dixon just drew these things all the time. They're beautifully laid out and incredibly, incredibly detailed. And it took a while, but eventually he got the attention of Golf Digest. And Golf Digest was sort of fascinated by his ability to draw these gorgeous golf courses. And once they profiled him in Golf Digest, and then they began to look at his conviction, which even on its face seemed very shaky. And ultimately what was discovered was that not only had someone else confessed to the shooting that resulted in the death of a particular individual, but there were lots of other problems. He had a defense attorney that never called a single witness. There was evidence of some coercion of witnesses by police. There were a number of problems with this. And so ultimately, between Golf Digest efforts, those of two attorneys who took the case pro bono, some Georgetown University students, his family members, particularly I think it was either his sister or his daughter that really sort of did a GoFundMe campaign to help fund his defense. He was ultimately released, but he's now 42 years old. He has spent half of his life in prison for something, for a crime he did not commit. But he was ultimately released as a result of all of these efforts, and it shows you the power of art and people's willingness to do good. But it's a fascinating story, and it seems like this art has kept him sane all these years in Attica. And he says, you know, he's not a bitter person, which I applaud him for, because I don't think I could say that if it were me. But he's out. He's been released, which is a good thing.
You know, I want to add one entity to the list of those who you say worked for his release. And I hope I get this right. And if I got it right, it was amazing to me. The story mentions that it says Golf Digest, I'm reading from it, Golf Digest's work eventually was eclipsed by the recent report filed by the Erie County District Attorney's Wrongful Convictions Unit, which is a new type of department popping up in various districts these ways. A wrongful conviction unit in an entity that convicts people for crimes. I mean, talk about enlightened criminal justice. This is an aberration, right? I assume most district attorney's offices do not have a wrongful convictions unit that looks into whether or not their prosecutions were ill-advised. Do they or do they?
No, I don't think most do. Suffolk County does.
Does?
I think they're growing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Suffolk County does.
Wow.
Yeah, so they're growing in popularity, and more district attorneys are recognizing sort of an affirmative obligation to review old convictions where the quality or the reliability of that conviction mm-hmm. has been called into question. And here, what you had was there had been a Erie County DA who'd been there for a very long time, who based on what I'm reading about him, clearly thought that there weren't enough convictions, that there were too many wrongful acquittals. He's no longer in Erie County. He was replaced by a guy named John Flynn, who was in the job for about a year, and it was under his leadership that Dixon was released, so he was clearly making use of that. But no, every DA's office, any DA's office that does, especially any DA's office that does homicides, that all of them do, should have a wrongful conviction unit.
I'll tell you, the investigative work by Golf Digest is really going to change the criminal justice system.
They got a spotlight, golf spotlight team over there.
Really, is unbelievable.
They're really to be applauded.
Are
yeah,
they
it's
ever?
Amazing.
You are totally right. Hey, Andrea, it's great to talk to you as always. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Andrea Cabral.
All right.
Coming up.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We are going to talk to Jared Bowen, but first I want to thank Andrea Cabral. She joins us every week. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety and current CEO of Ascend. Up next, Hamilton hits Boston. Does it live up to the hype? WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen joins us for that. And a controversy involving a little Falmouth museum. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In 2015, Hamilton made its Broadway debut. Obama was president. The musical's dominant theme celebrated immigrants, democracy, and the American experiment, had a specific resonance. Today, in Trump's America, those themes resonate for entirely different reasons. This year, it launched its second national tour, which brings it to the Boston Opera House. So after crisscrossing the country and even the Atlantic for a spin in London's West End, does it still hold up and live up to the hype? GBH's executive arts editor Jared Bowen apparently would know. He saw it on Broadway, and last night he was at the Boston Opera House. I was doing my laundry. He joins us for this and his review of other arts and culture events in and around town. Hey there, Jared Bowen.
Good afternoon.
Okay, so you saw it in Boston, Hamilton. What's your take?
I did. It is masterful and it's magisterial. It really is. And I think I had mentioned the last time I'd seen it, I was skeptical because I've seen thousands of performances over the years, and I thought, is this something that has just been hyped to oblivion? And it's not, because it's unbelievably inventive and revolutionary as a musical. So let's take us through what the musical is about. It is Lin-Manuel Miranda writing about Alexander Hamilton. He's an immigrant from the West Indies, comes to the U.S. He's viewed as dim. He's an orphan. He's an immigrant who must prove his worth. He's scrappy and hungry and not about to throw away his shot to be part of the American Revolution and then later to be part of the American experiment that is happening in terms of creating this democracy. By the way,
can I interrupt you? I want to say, since you mentioned his shot, why don't we enliven the festivities with a little clip from my shot, obviously, from Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. To King's College, I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough, a shiny piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is...
Yeah, my sense, Marjorie, is if we ever got to Seoul, we'd probably like it. So,
You know what? May I just say something that is incredible about this musical? That you can hear every word. You know, so many times you go to a musical and it's hard.
My God.
It's true. They enunciate every single word. That's a big deal.
Well, and I think it's in the writing. There are so many reasons that this show works. And let me just say, on a wide spectrum, it's because everything works. The costumes, the lighting, the set design, the choreography, which is just completely mesmerizing and exquisite, especially as they're rendering Civil War or Revolutionary War battles, rather. But you just heard this, the recording from the Broadway cast album, just as good here. But it's the way Lin-Manuel Miranda writes, which is he takes this very dense history and offers so many layers, and he does it musically through rap and through hip-hop and R&B and slight allusions to show tunes that I heard last night that I had never heard before. I mean, this was one of the great discoveries for me, is to be there again and to realize how much I had actually missed the first time, because there is so much that's happening wonderfully at once.
Which show tunes?
You're putting me on the spot, but okay. It's more, you know, periods of music that he refers to through the various characters' voices. But you also have to remember, Lin-Manuel Miranda won the Pulitzer Prize in Drama for this in 2016. What also captured my attention last night was the end of this show, and it's almost as if you are listening to Shakespeare for the poetry, for the cadence, and how he uses language. The man is absolutely brilliant, and let alone the fact that he's taking this massive Ron Chernow book that he lugged on vacation and saw this story that could surface, and then completely upends it, because we think of the founding fathers as these white men creating, making history. But he changes it, and for the most part, we're seeing black and Latino actors and few white men on stage.
God, we are the two biggest losers, Marjorie. I'm just thinking, we got to interview Ron Chernow. That's sort of close.
Yes, we did.
We got to interview his college roommate who did that great PBS thing. That's sort of close. I have watched the video, which is brilliant, of the first time he ever performed any of this, remember, at the White House?
Yeah.
And the look on Obama and Michelle Obama's face. I mean, it was... But we haven't quite taken the final step.
You know? I think we don't. We have a mutual friend who's working in our behalf.
She's not
Jim?
Offering me any tickets, but she is. Can you compare? I mean, obviously, you say you saw more in it. Obviously, it's also a different time. I don't know if you saw, did. You see it when Obama was still president, or did you see it when Trump was president?
I was trying to remember that. I think I did see it when Obama was still.
Well,
president.
That's different.
I think it was during the election.
Obviously, context is a huge amount, right?
Absolutely, because this is all about these men, and I will say that Lin-Manuel Miranda, not that they're a central focus, but he writes the women too, and it's especially resonant when they say, we're waiting for the sequel, Thomas Jefferson, and you kind of feel that the sequel is being fulfilled only maybe right now, now I just lost my point. That doesn't happen. What were we talking about?
I have no idea. Who are you
again? The point is, we should all go see it if we can get tickets.
Oh, are you kidding? I mean, can you imagine? Have you ever...
Oh, I know what I was going
to
say.
Oh, and then I have something to say. Okay. I won't forget, as I will. But go ahead.
I was going to say that you're looking at what they're trying to do, and you think... I spent some time thinking after I was driving home, what would they think today? Of course, I think they would be happy at what we've become, but not entirely happy with the way America has turned out. But that it's so palpable, their dreams, their vision for what society is.
You know, in the film that was made about it, I think the PBS film by his roommate who was with
Alex
us.
Alex Horowitz, yeah.
Yeah, right. They interview one of the late night hosts. Who's the late night?
Jimmy Fallon.
Right, Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Fallon says exactly what I thought. Of course, he's seen it, and again, we haven't. He said, "Yeah, I'm always, I'm paraphrasing, I'm always nervous about things that everybody says is the greatest thing ever. It never lives up to the hype." And again, that's a paraphrase. I have not spoken to one person ever who said it doesn't live up, whether it's Callie with her friends doing that wonderful excursion to Chicago for the day to see it. Have you spoken to anybody who didn't love this thing?
I spoke to one person who's a
famous
actor who had some criticism. By and large, she loved it.
Who?
I can't tell you because it was off the record, but that's the only person. By and large, she loved it, though. She had a couple criticisms. By the way, I will say that for those people who think they can't get tickets, I did talk to Broadway in Boston last night, and I don't want to blow up expectations, but there are a select number of tickets that are released every single day, and there's also a lottery that happens. So
Chelsea won the lottery. Do you know that? Our leader won the lottery. Yeah,
and I got
here in Boston.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
And I got tickets for my children in New York through that release of those tickets. All of a sudden, they put them up, and you can get them and seats together and everything, and they're the least expensive ones.
So you can either go to the Opera House, go to BroadwayInBoston.com, or go to Ticketmaster. Again, I don't want to blow up expectations. It's just a very select number, but there is still a chance to see the show.
We're talking to Jared Bowen, Executive Arts Editor here at GBH.
So I am dying to talk to you about what's happened in this in Falmouth, this place called Highfield Hall, where the director of the exhibit hall there has canceled an exhibit by Sally Mavor. It contained political content. And what I read is that he only wants political content that's nonpartisan. I don't know how that is possible.
All right. So, and I am equally dying to talk to you about this because I think this is a really interesting and very important story, which I first learned about yesterday from the Falmouth Times. I saw the story on the CapeNews.net that was sent to me. So here's the story. Highfield Hall and Gardens is a very small cultural institution in Falmouth, and they put on exhibitions, and they had been planning for a year, more than a year, to do an exhibition of fiber artists in which Sally Mavor, a fiber artist, would have her own show called Liberty and Justice, New Artwork by Sally Mavor. And as a fiber artist, she, like a lot of other artists working today, have gravitated toward the more political because of the times in which we exist. So what she's done with her husband is she creates these little dolls, these little fiber artist art dolls, which are quite captivating, I have to say. And she created a film with her husband. You can go on YouTube to watch it, or you can go to her website, which is wefolkstudio.com. I think it's exceptionally well done, especially since this is the first time they've done it. And it's called Liberty and Justice, A Cautionary Tale in the Land of the Free. And what you find is basically Hansel and Gretel wandering through the woods, and they start to follow these pretty pink signs like huge and great again. Things are looking good where they're going, even though a shirtless Vladimir Putin is kind of following and lurking in the woods, watching them. Kellyanne Conway welcomes into this candy sugared landscape, and then they end up in the cottage, not unlike the witch in Hansel and Gretel, that is they're welcomed into it by Melania and Donald Trump. And then you see these various iterations of Donald Trump as notorious dictators and autocrats throughout history, including Adolf Hitler. So here's what happened. Sally Mavor told the Highfield Hall and Museum, I spoke to both the museum and Sally Mavor actually this morning. Sally Mavor told the museum about her political art as early as June. She advised them to take a look at the video. The executive director, Peter Franklin, did not do that. He admits he made a huge mistake. He only looked at the video about 2 weeks before the show was to start. And he basically thought, this is inappropriate for our institution. It's too political. We cannot go forward with this. It was broached with Sally Mavor. They asked her if she would be willing to withdraw her art. They posed the question, but basically she answered, there's nothing left if you take my political art out. So essentially she feels censored. So Highfield Hall and Gardens said they did this for two reasons. They didn't invite anyone else to participate, so they didn't make it equal. They see this as a partisan issue. I challenged them on this. I said, how do you see this as a partisan issue if you're talking about the president in a in his position, he kind of transcends parties at this point because he represents the country. They didn't necessarily have an answer for me on that, but they felt like they couldn't present one political perspective without presenting another. I also have questions about that. I mean, if you're going to have, if you're going to look for another voice, you're just going to drag anybody into the museum who might offer something else, somebody who hasn't spent a year creating this work. They also, I mean, and I do feel for the museum, they also pointed out that they leased the house from the town of Falmouth and they weren't sure of the town's views on bringing political voices into a town-owned structure. So that is their point of view. They realize that they were wrong. They don't believe they censored her. They believe they have to be careful.
When you say wrong, you mean that they hadn't vetted the thing earlier. Right. That's what you mean wrong. Okay.
Right. And as I said, they don't believe they censored her. And I've been there. I understand what a small museum, how they operate. They have a small staff. They have a small budget. They can't operate with the foresight and heft of a Museum of Fine Arts, which weighs these issues regularly. As I said, I spoke to Sally Maver. She does see it as censorship. She also has sympathy for the Highfield Hall because she has exhibited there before. But here's the great news. She says this has actually been really good. It's taken on a whole new life as this story has spread on Facebook. She's had thousands of people write her from around the world. And now the New England Quilting Museum in Lowell is going to open a show of her work starting next week, and it'll run through December. So her work is getting a platform after all. My concern here, and we've talked about this at various times over my time with you, is how artists' voices are being constricted, and how do you measure what the artistic point of view is with the politics of the day? And these small museums, which outnumber the larger museums in this country, if they feel that they're in a position where they can't allow artistic voices, where does that leave us?
And one last thing about this, all through art history, correct me if I'm wrong, art has been political in many cases, challenging the powers that be.
It has, through plays, through exhibitions, through artwork. And Highfield Hall says, we understand that, but we've never had to confront this before, and we realize now we never had a policy for it. They want to move forward. They want to meet with the town, although they have not set up a meeting yet. But it's something they want to address.
And when is this thing going to open in Lowell?
It opens next week.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Well,
and
I have to say, look at the film. It's really, really fun.
I'm going to look at it immediately. Well, not immediately because I'm on the radio now,
that's
but I will.
Point.
Okay. Let's talk about Glenn Close, the movie The Wife. We'll start with playing a little clip from the trailer. This is a movie about Glenn Close. She plays the wife of a man who just won the Nobel Prize. Here's the clip.
I am aware of Joe's various indiscretions. His affairs have nothing to do with you. That's a deep-seated fear of inadequacy.
Don't paint me as a victim. I am much more interesting than that.
Don't walk away from me, Diamond!
I can't do it anymore. I can't take it. I can't take the humiliation.
You have an occupation?
I do.
And what is that?
I am a kingmaker.
Ooh, is it a good one?
It is good because from start to finish, Glenn Close is absolutely captivating in this
She's
film.
Great.
So you meet her and right away we understand that her husband, Joe Castleman, has been awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. But she always has this sort of happy but muted response to him. This is based on, the 2003 novel by Meg Wolitzer. And he's invited to Stockholm, of course, for the ceremony. She goes, as does their son, who is just trying to get his father's approval, lurking in sort of the background. You just heard his voice is Christian Slater, who wants to be the biographer, who has questions about the work. But as the film progresses, you begin to wonder what her reaction is born of. And there are flashbacks, and you understand that she may have had more to do with her husband's success than anybody is acknowledging. And Glenn Close, there's a lot of Oscar talk for her. Just give it. I haven't seen everything, but I feel like at this point you should give it to her because she's never won. And as I said, she's mesmerizing start to finish.
Well, why are you so into this? I mean, you have a look on your face.
Because it is so relatable.
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, how's the scene where she drops the rabbit in the boiling water? Is that really gruesome? Or is that
no bunnies here?
You know, I was going to say I am like nobody else is. Gilda Radner was a genius. Unlike, and talk about timing. Marjorie, before we go on the air, is talking about the story where Chevy Chase is saying, I can't get a job. Yeah. SNL is horrible.
Yeah, he's sober again. No one will give him a job. Probably because he's 74. It's age discrimination.
Let's start with a clip here, too. This is a trailer from the film about Gilda Radner.
Hi, I'm Gilda Radner. And, okay, now.
She was the very first performer chosen for the cast of Saturday Night Live.
Dear Roseanne, Roseanne, Dan.
From the time I was a kid, I loved to pretend.
I can't imagine how I got famous. I just took the next job and millions of people were watching me do it.
People want to know, well, what made you funny? And I know what made me funny. My biggest motivation has always been love.
It's called Love Gilda. Is this, well, I'm confused. Is this in theaters or on CNN or both? What's going on exactly?
It'll be both. It's opening in theaters this week on Friday and tomorrow. And then later on in the year, and perhaps even early next year, it'll be broadcast on CNN because, as we know, they've been doing these great documentaries like RBG.
Yeah. But, and by the way, for very young listeners, she died young, obviously, of ovarian cancer, yes. For those who don't
know. So, first of all, it's been almost 30 years, and she was only 42 years old.
Wow.
Wow.
How is it?
It's really lovely because this is the first time we've had this kind of look at her. So the filmmaker is Lisa Diapolito, and she had been making films for Gilda's Club, which are the surviving clubs that deal with cancer patients set up by Gene Wilder in the wake of his wife's death. And until now, nobody has really, none of her family, friends, colleagues have spoken out publicly about her. And for the first time, they do. And not only that, but through the family, Lisa Diapolito has gotten access to tapes that Gilda Radner recorded, to diaries that she recorded. She was very meticulous, and it charts her whole career. And she was obviously so successful and so funny. And through childhood films, family films, you see how funny she was. Just at the outset, she was a physical comedian, just like Lucille Ball or Laurel and Hardy. I mean, she had it from the beginning, as I think a lot of people do. But of course, she was riddled with doubt. She just wanted to be the best. She had body image issues because she was a larger child, and her mother reminded her of that. So she had an eating disorder that she had to be treated. And you have these really painful entries where she's talking about really essentially not liking herself. But at the same time, this takes you into her humor, and you have the appreciation about even when she, in her pre-Saturday Night Live days, when she was with Dan Aykroyd and all these kings of comedy, and she was the lone female standing out, and they just, you see the look that they had to just to be in her orbit.
That's
fantastic.
I can't wait. I didn't know she was the first hire until I just heard that clip either for SNL.
Okay, there's a new movie out about Lizzie Borden.
Your hometown.
My hometown. Always say my aunt and uncle lived in the house, that not the murder house, but the house Lizzie Borden moved to after the murder.
No.
I told you that a million times.
No.
Yeah, we spent our whole childhood looking for the axe. You know, of course, we never found it. But anyway, let's play a little clip from the trailer for Lizzie Borden, and then Jared can tell us all about it.
The new housemaid, ma'am. It's Bridget.
My name's Lizzie.
Do you find your room comfortable? It can get quite hot up there. Sometimes it's best to leave the door open.
It's all right, sweet girl.
Father, have you done something?
Have I done something? To your knowledge, did your father have any enemies?
This is America, sir. Every man with a pulse has enemies.
Pretty good line, I should say. How's this?
It's a different kind of film. It's very slow moving, and it takes a different conjecture about what happened here.
It is different.
Of course, in real life, she was acquitted.
Wait, how do you know it's different? What do you mean?
Because I've read a lot of the books about Lizzie Borden. Okay, this is a version I have not seen.
It really slows it down, and you get a look at Lizzie Borden, played by Chloe Sevigny, as somebody who doesn't, and she's so good in this film, who doesn't have a lot of freedom. She wants to get out of her very constricted home. By the way, she was from an extremely wealthy family, which I didn't realize.
Oh, yeah.
Really extreme wealth for the time. But she wants to break out into society, go out on her own. She's not allowed or she's cautioned against even going outside into public by her stepmother and her father. And so she's dealing with this. As you get a sense of her as somebody who's suffering medically from seizures. And then arrives suddenly Kristen Stewart playing the house servant who comes into the home and is essentially sexually abused by the father. This speculates that there was a relationship between the maid and Lizzie Borden. And then when it became too much, essentially victims of the patriarchy because of the father's oppressive thumb, they both conspired to take matters into their own hands.
By the way, just as an aside, when I went to see Ryan Landry in Provincetown in Brooklahoma, mm-hmm. he told me the night before at Showgirls, which is the other thing he was doing, guess who was in the audience?
Chloe Savini.
Yeah. Pretty impressive, huh?
That is very impressive.
You don't seem like you loved the film, though. Did you, or you didn't?
Well, I wouldn't say I loved it, but I liked it a lot and I appreciated it. It does move very methodically, and so I think that'll turn off a lot of people. But as I think about the stars here are Kristen Stewart and Chloe Savini, because you really get into their characters and their point of view, which is most important, and therefore it makes it a very successful film, and it makes you reconsider that story and what the consequences were. I mean, we read that she essentially was kind of a shut-in for the rest of her life because of the way society viewed her, even though she was acquitted.
That is absolutely true.
I can't believe your family has a connection to this. That is really exciting.
I know, it's very exciting. Maplecroft, that was the name of the house.
And you said it was where in relation to the house?
Well, the murder house was kind of in downtown Fall River on 2nd Street.
Yeah.
And the house that she moved to was more in the sort of highlands of the snazzy section of Fall River on French Street. And it was a big gray house. And it was a big house. And,
sounds like there's some things Marjorie's not telling us.
I know
that
she's
feeling
being very cryptic here.
I know.
Statute of limitations has run, Marjorie.
No, I had nothing to do with hacking anybody to death. I just want to be clear about that. Do we have time for one more?
We actually don't.
Oh, no. Okay. We have to wait till next week then to talk about the niceties.
Nice to see you, Jared.
We'll get to
good
that
work,
then.
By the way, on this Highfield Hall
reporting.
Thing. You're really advancing the story. It's great.
Thank you. I think it's an important one, too.
Great.
Coming up, we're going to talk to Paul Revel about all matters educational, including the challenger to Charlie Baker, Jay Gonzalez, plan to get money out of the endowments of some of the richest colleges in Massachusetts to pay for things like an improved MBTA. Paul Revel joins us next. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. And this week, WGBH News released the National Higher Education Poll. One of the questions was about a Trump-era plan to tax university endowments, which the federal government did this year, taxing endowments of the richest not-for-profit schools. Half of the people polled are against this tax. So what does this mean for Jay Gonzalez? Because the Democratic nominee for governor just released his solution for paying for his education and transportation plan, taxing Harvard and the state's other wealthiest universities and colleges. Join us for his take on this. And other education headlines is Paul Revel. Paul's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie.
Hello, Paul Revel. Well, let's start out with this poll that we did here at WGBH, a national poll, as Jim just said. One of the things that was fascinating to me is that we found in this poll that 86% of Americans want a racially and ethnically diverse student body in college campuses. But most of them, 72%, don't support using race as a factor to get there in college admissions. So
It's puzzling. It's a kind of paradox, and it means the devil's usually in the details because, you wonder what people responding to the poll were thinking when people said using race. In other words, all things being equal, using race, or using race without all things being equal. I mean, it's a different approach. But I think there is that paradox there that most parents, I think, and students as well at the higher education level, but parents generally realize we're raising our children to live in a very diverse and increasingly diverse society. And they want to go on campuses and have experiences with other students in classrooms and in the whole civic engagement of school that's diverse and reflects the society we're in. At the same time, when push comes to shove at admissions time, people have their own notions about what ought to be acceptable. Should it be just one test score? Should it be GPAs? Should it be outside activities? Should it be balancing a class to reflect the society? So these are the questions.
I think it's that you're all in favor of diversity, but if you're a white parent, you don't want your white kid to be edged out by someone who's of color.
Yeah. Well, except this poll says the 72% who don't want, let me read it exactly, from the 72% who oppose using race as a factor in admissions, it was relatively consistent amongst white and non-white people. The reason I don't find that so strange, I think it's typical of the, if I may be unkind, of the cluelessness of the American people on so many things. We want transportation to be better. We want better schools. We want preschool,
right,
as long as we don't have to pay for it.
Right.
I mean, and so there are a lot of disconnects between what we want in a society and our ability to do something, whether it's have affirmative action as a factor, as the Supreme Court currently says is okay, in schools or paying taxes. So, but there's another interesting thing, which is a wonderful coincidence. I think it was just sort of serendipity. The federal government, under the Republicans in Congress and Donald Trump, supported taxing the investment, the profits essentially on the investment.
That's right.
The investment income, not the whole endowment, which is one of the things Jay Gonzalez is proposing over a certain level, but rather a smaller piece of it, the investment income from that. Am I right about that?
Well, yeah, no, the big distinction between what Gonzalez has proposed and what the Trump administration actually did with the tax bill was the difference between taxing the income versus taxing the assets.
Right.
And there's a huge difference. I mean, the implications of Trump's proposal that it's not a proposal, but the new tax law on Harvard is, north of $40 million a year that would be paid, whereas in the case of Gonzalez's proposal, you're talking about north of $400 million.
It's a huge difference for Harvard we're talking about, as opposed to overall.
Yeah, to give you a chance to put that in perspective, and naturally, I work for Harvard, but I think it's a spectacularly bad proposal in the first place. But it would amount to...
Which one? Trump's or Gonzalez?
Gonzalez's proposal.
Okay.
Would amount to about a $22,000 per student levy on Harvard per year to a fund that actually is used, comes from donations from all kinds of individuals who are favorably disposed to the university, and is used for either for scholarships or to underwrite operating costs to keep the cost of tuition and running the university down. So the reason Democrats widely opposed this kind of proposal when it came forward in the Trump administration was to say, well, this is part of a deliberate attack on higher education, and particularly on those institutions that harbor faculty members who have critical views of the administration. Now we have right on our home base a leading Democratic candidate, former cabinet colleague of mine and friend of mine.
Oh, of course, that's right.
Who I respect and like as a friend.
Patrick administration.
Proposing something that you have to think is opportunistic, that this is a pot of money that's around. He's being pressured to come up with proposals to fund some very generous thoughts that he has about what we should do to improve education and improve transportation. I just think it's the wrong place to go. It's a bit like the Patriots and their new wide receiver choice.
Oh, excuse me. By the way, I never said what the poll results were on the Trump plan or the Trump law. Half of the respondents in the WGBH News poll said colleges should not pay taxes on their endowments, while 43% said they should, and 7% were unsure. See, I have to think more about this, and you know much more about where the money goes. Part of the problem, I guess, is twofold. One, Jay Gonzalez supported the millionaire's tax, which the Supreme Court, SJC, said was unconstitutional. And if you support billions of dollars going to transportation and education, you got to find the money somewhere. Two, I think he really made a colossal mistake during the campaign, including in the debate that I moderated between him and Massey. He said he was going to raise taxes progressively to pay for this, but he wasn't telling anybody what tax it was going to be and how much.
Right.
I think he had to fill in the blanks, which doesn't – but thirdly, until the universities – not Harvard, about Harvard, this is about all of them – until the universities honor their payments in lieu of taxation taxes. Obligations.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know it, these places are tax-exempt. And what in terms of the property tax, and what local governments do is negotiate these voluntary agreements with the universities where they pay generally a fraction of what they would have paid if their land was taxable under the property tax, like your house is and your house and a business is. The report the Globe does almost every year shows the vast majority, and I'm not going to name names because I'm not sure who were good payers and who weren't, the vast majority of universities do not meet the obligation they have agreed to in terms of supporting public services beyond them. So I surely don't want to speak for Gonzalez, but I would assume he'd say that's where the money is. And two, he didn't say the latter, but he probably should. They're not meeting their other obligations. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, this is a selective class of universities that have been selected. So there are many universities that aren't fulfilling their pilot obligations, most of which wouldn't be hit by this.
Right, because they're not the wealthiest ones. Right. You're right about that. That's a good
point. And the wealthiest ones tend to
do
better.
That's probably why he's not saying it, and I probably shouldn't have.
That's a function of state policy. That's a function of local policy there. And you expect local officials to tighten up and strengthen those policies, which they have the option to do. I just think a more logical pace, you know, for example, one of the areas in which he needs money is to improve the MBTA. And we haven't revisited the gas tax for ages. And it's
well,
still,
we actually have.
The
voters, your boss, wanted to raise the gas tax, Deval Patrick, significantly.
Because
the legislature
it was
too scared.
Way. They did it the wrong way.
No, but then most recently, and this is what Jeff Diehl's running on against Elizabeth Warren because he was one of the leaders of the campaign, the voters, I think stupidly, voted to repeal the inflation adjustment on the gas tax.
Because the legislature had a written-in way to avoid
an inflation
kind of
adjustment. It's called an inflation adjustment.
They didn't have to revote this. And that really irked a lot of people.
That's what an inflation adjustment is.
Well, they need to put it – if they want to do it, they should do it in a way that the legislature has to step up and approve it so they're not like sneaking away
but the point
from
is
voting
the,
on it.
I just think revisiting that with a different strategy is the way to approach it, going to the gas tax. I mean, you got to think about the consequences. I mean, if you're running Harvard University and they're going to slap that kind of a tax on your endowment, which eventually is going to erode your endowment entirely, you might think about expanding, if you were Harvard or MIT, to the Midwest, you know, where our president's already expressed an interest, rather than suffer taxation like this, confiscatory taxes.
Harvard's going to expand in the Midwest?
No, I'm not saying Harvard's going to expand in the Midwest, but I'm just saying you create consequence. Any tax, if you had a millionaire's tax, you create an incentive for millionaires to move to Providence or to move to Manchester, New Hampshire. If you create this kind of tax on universities, you create an incentive for large universities, prestigious universities, to expand their operations elsewhere if you're going to get hit with these kinds of taxes.
Yeah, I don't know where in the Midwest is going to compete with Cambridge, Paul. I'm just not sure.
I think these universities are worried about having an impact across the country. And that's a minor point. That's a minor point. But this is just way too heavy a levy on a select number of institutions. I realize that it's handy. It's convenient. And it gives a ready answer to the question of how you're going to pay for all these things you want to do, Jay. I just think it's a wrong answer.
And by the way, but the good part of this, even if you don't like it, is there's a tax proposal on the table which can actually be debated, and it will be. And by the way, on October, are we supposed to mention the date? I think we are.
October 17th.
October 17th, we will be doing our debate in the governor's race, Marjorie and I, in a debate between Jay Gonzalez and the incumbent, Charlie Baker. We're talking to Paul Revel.
Another great story, which does seem to make total sense to me, is that one of the reasons for the achievement gap between kids of color, and especially boys and white kids, is the lack of diversity in the teaching force. You know, I'm obviously white, but I remember what a big deal it was when my son in second grade had a man teacher.
Yeah.
Because there's so few men teaching in elementary schools, and it was a really it was kind of a life-changing thing for him.
Do you have those stats in front of you from the New York Times about what percentage are white and what percentage are women? I was
shocked.
The
workforce
is
becoming even more female. 77% of teachers in public and private elementary and high schools are women.
I was shocked, actually.
Up from 71% 3 decades ago. And the teaching force has grown more racially diverse, but it's still 80% white, down from 80%. So the argument in this piece is that particularly little boys of color, little black little boys, don't see anybody like themselves.
Right. No, I mean, I think it's critically important. I can remember my own elementary school experience having a male teacher for 5th and 6th grade.
It's
and when
big
they
deal,
got extended to 6th grade, it was huge.
Yeah.
It made a huge difference. And for a long time, we've argued this is another one of the myths that we have about race, is that race shouldn't matter, that it, you know, it's all about what your teacher knows and who's most qualified and so forth, as though some people from some races are more qualified than other races. We find out now with some research that it really does make a difference on all sorts of levels, on the level of gender and on the level of race. And, you know, many of our school, I mean, most urban superintendents I know struggle with this issue. They're trying very hard to diversify the teaching force, which is the obvious answer to this question. And we have a problem. We're not attracting highly qualified minorities to come into the profession at the levels that they used to come into. Enrollments at graduate schools of education and teaching programs are down, and attrition is up in the teaching field. So we have shortages. So this question of diversifying, it's one thing to want to do it. It's another thing to be able to execute on doing it and get people to come in. So we've got to think about making the profession more attractive to the very kind of people we need to diversify our teaching force.
By the way, Senators Hirono and Gillibrand are announcing they received a letter signed by more than 1,000 Holton Arms alumni. That's where Professor Ford went to school, supporting it. I don't think it's supporting her on the facts, I don't believe, if you guys can check, of the incident, obviously, but rather, I assume, speaking to her honor.
As long as you mentioned Senator Mazie Hirono from Hawaii, I just want to interject quickly. She said, guess who's perpetuating all these kind of actions, meaning rushing through this appointment of Kavanaugh? She said, it's men in this country. And I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up and step up and do the right thing for a change. I love that.
Are we making any progress? Getting back to this teacher diversity.
Sorry, Paul.
We're going the wrong direction. We're going the wrong direction on the male-female diversity, according to the stats.
Apparently,
yep. And we're making some progress on the racial diversity, correct?
That's right. Yep.
Okay. By the way, the only problem, I agree we should have more male teachers, but as you were speaking, I was thinking one of the first male teachers I had was the one that figured out that the book report I submitted was on a book that did not exist. So
that means he was a good teacher.
That was a rather painful experience.
Yep. He had a good
me.
Detector.
So, Paul, we did you a favor,
oh,
I think.
Oh, good. I'm always
You may recall
in
the last couple of times you've been here, you have criticized the mayor of Boston, or at least questioned why the mayor of Boston, when he announced that Laura Parrill would be the interim superintendent, he did not simultaneously announce that there would be a process, a search process.
That's right.
For the mayor. Did you hear what the mayor had to say about it?
I did not.
Well, here is it. When he was with us last Friday, this is Mayor Walsh, we asked him about Paul's criticism, as I just described, and here is what the mayor had to say.
Well, I think when Paul was Secretary of Education, it would have been great if we figured out the funding for charter schools under his leadership, because the city of Boston has lost money under that, and we're paying more and more money every year. So I appreciate Paul's comments on that publicly, but I'd appreciate if we could have a conversation and talk about how we're moving forward.
You want to respond to the mayor, Paul?
Well, this is clever changing of the subject,
He did address the subject. Let me just add that to the – he ultimately did say, in short order, soon we will have a process announced.
Number one, it's changing the subject. Number two, it's sort of an ad hominem attack. But setting that aside, I'd be happy to have a conversation with him about it. I have talked with various people, including some people on the school committee, about it. I've been clear. I don't have any authority, so it's not up to me. I'm happy to help out. I maintain the position that I've articulated from the beginning about this, is that when you announce an interim superintendent, particularly where a community is sensitive about its ability to participate in the process, because we have an appointed school committee rather than an elected school committee, you should be bending over backwards to make available to people some voice in the process and let them know there will be a process. So I think it was almost inevitable. I view this as a misstep by the mayor, kind of a tone-deaf political problem that he's created for himself. You could have predicted that these groups were going to come forward. It's a mystery to me why they haven't clarified already that the acting superintendent will not be a candidate, which seems to me to be the only open course of action now, but they're leaving that hanging. And at the same time, they're leaving hanging the idea of whether or not we're going to have a process. And I think for all the reasons some of the opponents have brought forward, not that I don't respect Laura Perrill, I think she's a fine educator and education advocate, but the way in which her appointment happened makes it very difficult to conceive of her getting that appointment permanently. And I think the committee, my big worry is this is going to cause us to have to revisit the appointed committee versus the elected committee because people are feeling they don't have any voice.
Well, I think I know I'm in a minority in this room. We should revisit the elected committee, but we won't have that debate today because Marjorie and I will get in a big fight.
No, it's true. We should bring back Pixie Palladino.
No, democracy is a horrible thing. The notion that the people could actually pick those who represent them in matters relating to education is really
and
an
in all
abomination.
My years as a reporter, I've never seen more corruption than I've seen going on at school committee meetings.
Corruption? What corruption are you talking about? That's why I didn't want to get into
this. Are you
this.
Kidding? Everybody's hiring their brother-in-law. I mean, it's just outrageous.
Well, they're all
on.
The
they're
most
They're always
qualified.
In executive session. They always say the same thing. We're discussing personnel. And suddenly they come out of executive session and 12 brother-in-laws have been hired.
Can
in
I
the
tell
interim.
You, this proves you have no idea what you're talking about because when I was on the Cambridge City Council and went into executive session, it was not to hire anybody. It was eat the free dinner from the SNS deli. Now, before you go away, I'm surprised to hear you say what you said about Perrill. You seem to be saying it because the process has been so screwed up, including not announcing a permanent process. Does this have anything to do with the fact that this bunch of community organizations had demanded, requested that there be a declaration that Perrill do the same thing, that she's saying now that she will not be a candidate for the permanent position? We asked Marty Walsh about this the other day, and Walsh's position was she may not be. I'm paraphrasing what he said. Why do you believe that? What's the basis for you believing that she should declare herself out of the running?
Well, number one, it's fairly standard when you put interims in place that interims make a declaration that they aren't going to be candidates for the permanent position so that they can fully concentrate on doing the work at hand and so that nobody from the outside feels that someone inside the system has an inside track because that tends to discourage people from applying. So I think that was generally true, and I said that from the beginning. I think it's even more true now that you have somebody in office and a dozen sort of influential civic groups have come forward and said, we don't want her. And at the same time, she says she's being a candidate. This looks like a very messy situation. And again, I think is a deterrent to candidates coming in. I also think it creates a situation in which it will be very unlikely that she could be successful under those circumstances. So I think the better part of valor here would be to retreat. Both for her sake and for the mayor's sake, to declare it open and to get that process out there as soon as possible so people know there's going to be a genuine process, both people in the community and candidates at large who might be taking an interest in Boston.
So next time the mayor's with us in a couple of weeks, we'll play what you said in response to him.
Yeah, there we go.
And then we'll play for you what he said
well,
in response to
we didn't talk about his
you.
Charter schools comment either because it's not up to the Secretary of Education to solve charter school problems. Boston has charter school problems because people are leaving the public school system and getting into charter schools, and the system is losing money. We have an established formula for how we solve that. I admit that the legislature itself has not fully funded the reimbursements, but I'm not in favor of a new reimbursement formula that provides additional compensation to Boston because Boston is losing students to charter schools.
We'll play that for him, too. Paul, it's good to see you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Why are you sighing?
Because I'm thinking how sad it is that there are still so many parents and children who can't get into the Boston charter schools.
Well, people spoke on that issue 2-1. They spoke on a ballot campaign.
Did speak on the issue, but once again, you know, you always talk about rent control that the state decided for a lot of cities that didn't even affect. It was kind of the same thing with, you know, everybody in Brookline outraged about charter schools. There were not going to be any charter schools in Brookline. It's the cities where they're needed, and they don't have enough of them. Anyway.
Bye, Paul.
It's a big divider.
Revo joins us regularly. He's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. Paul, thank you very much for coming in. Coming up, the big egos and big money that make a professional football is central to Mark Leibovich's gossipy and great new book, Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. We're going to talk to him about the NFL and a little bit about politics as well. Mark Leibovich is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, based in D.C., specializes in politics, from profiles of Paul Ryan to President Trump to his books about our political apparatus, which runs on big money, big egos, and big media. When he sets off to write his latest book about the NFL, it might have seemed like a departure from all that, but it turns out the NFL, with its big money, big egos, and culture of backbiting, is a lot like D.C. The book is called Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. And yes, his hometown team, the Patriots, are central to the book. Mark was born here. He used to work at the Boston Phoenix when he was young and irresponsible. He'll be at the Harvard bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock. Mark, it's great to see you again.
Great to be here, guys. Now, should I be standing up? You guys are both
you
standing.
Don't have you, to. You don't have to. We just up. Do that because it gives us
okay.
more energy for
yeah,
3 hours.
Yeah, because I'm feeling, you know, I want to make sure I match your energy. I can tell.
It's your choice. Whatever right. you want
no,
to
no,
do,
I'm,
Mark.
I'm very comfortable.
But let me just tell you, you have got so much juicy, gossipy stuff in this book. I just absolutely love it, especially some of the stuff we learned about Tom Brady, which I did not know, including, I love this, somebody described him as having this cultivated elegance so that Tom Brady gets to do the ads for Aston Martin and poor Eli Manning gets stuck with, like, Ford, you know?
Oh, I'm sure Eli Manning would not trade for, I mean, no, I was like, I think it's, I mean, Eli Manning and, like, Ford.
He's a Ford guy.
He's a Ford guy.
He's a Ford guy, you're right.
Actually, I think a Ford guy is going to probably win an election in this country more than an Aston Martin.
Well,
who knows?
That's probably true. Yeah. Pretty boys don't necessarily get elected to be president. But anyway, tell us a great anecdote about Tom Brokaw walking down the street in Manhattan and seeing the poster of Mr. Uggs, pretty boy Tom Brady.
That will involve scrubbing the anecdote with some profanity. So
yes.
I will do that. Tom Brokaw, when he was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago, was going through grueling chemotherapy treatments. You know, 75, 76-year-old, really rough winter for him. He used to have this morning walk where he would leave his apartment on the Upper East Side, just sort of walk, go get his coffee, get his bagel, get his newspaper. And in these bitter cold days, there was always a poster of Tom Brady doing his Uggs like thing, just Tom Brady being the full Tom Brady. And Brokaw would stand, I mean, Brokaw, he would think, a guy who has it all, right, would stand before the poster every morning and just say, blank you. And so he told me this once, and I decided that would be a perfect, I don't know why, I just said, you know, this is the kind of thing you can throw in a book, right? You don't have editors. You can just, like, let's indulge that.
Exactly.
So, I put it in, and he actually told me that he met Tom Brady at the Kentucky Derby once and told him that story, and Tom and his friend, Tom Brady and his friends were very, very amused and actually very flattered. So this is where people on that stratosphere operate on each other.
Why did Brady talk to you as much as he? I mean, we hear, no, and again, you're a Boston kid. I know you're a Patriots fan.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Patriots fans in the media.
Yeah.
There are a lot of pretty prominent, respected media people, but he has really sheltered these, other than those pathetic little interviews he does during the Monday night games with Gray, whatever his name is. And he does a pretty decent interview some Monday mornings on WEI. Why did he talk to you so much?
I don't know. I think it was it helps that I'm not a sports writer. I mean, I think I live
Wouldn't
in
that
Washington.
Be scarier, though? Because of all the Trump stuff?
No, this was well before the Trump.
Oh, right.
I first met him in 2016. And, he actually had a pretty earnest, like, interest in politics, and that he actually I remember he was asking me the first time we met a lot of questions about how politics worked and how bizarre it seemed. Because if you look at it, some of his best and most revealing interviews have been on subjects that have nothing to do with football. He did this amazing interview with Tom Ford, the fashion guy, once that, I mean, you know, he cares about that stuff, but it went into really, like, pretty deep places. I mean, he did this interview with Steve Croft on 60 Minutes in, like, 2004 that went into spirituality and about how he was like, you know, he's won two Super Bowls, and is that all there is? And he told me that people have sent him Bibles after he said that. I mean,
well,
weird stuff.
He's into Sanskrit,
like,
you said, right?
Yeah, no, he does a lot of Eastern stuff. I mean, he's a very, this was what impressed me about him and what surprised me about him. He's a free thinker. I mean, you could say naive, you could say possibly You know, Alex Guerrero, his body coach, has been accused of all kinds of things, and he's, you know, he's had a pretty shady past. But he's open to things, and so I think he just liked that I was different and we'd never met. And, you know, I went to Michigan. I'm from here, so we're exactly the same, right?
You know, is there – I mean, anybody who reads your stuff, I hope, would agree that you play it straight down the middle, and you're pretty tough in the best sense of the word. Yeah. Was there not a piece of a fanboy kind of thing?
A huge
I
piece.
Shook his hand at a head yeah. shaving thing for cancer about six mm-hmm. months ago. Yeah. And as I said to him, I was ready not to wash it for 6 months. Was there not a piece of that with you?
There was a huge piece of that. I was embarrassingly open about it. I've interviewed, you know, presidents and CEO types and all kinds of people. And this is the one I was really nervous about. I mean, I remember, like, literally my palms are sweaty. I got there early because it was a hot day in New York. This was, I guess, around July 4th. And I was a six-year-old boy again. And, like, Carl Yastrzemski was, like, you know, yelling at my sister at Star Market. Actually, that was Jim Rice. You're a kid, and everyone is just physically and just in all ways bigger. And that's sort of what it was like. I was like 40-something years old at the time, and there he was. So, yeah, it was an odd dynamic.
So is he prettier when you're 3 feet away from him than he is on TV?
You know, he's a good-looking guy. There's no question. I don't think I'm breaking any news there. Yeah. But you know, but our relationship was more about just connecting over all great spiritual things.
Of course. So. We're talking to Mark Leibovich from the New York Times Magazine. His latest is Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. So I think you were responsible for solving how the MAGA hat got into the locker. You
Apparently.
Deserve credit for that, right? And so I assume most people have read about this since the book has been out for a bit. Tell people how we believe it got there.
Well, no, Robert Kraft, who I assume had one of the very limited and coveted edition MAGA hats early on in the Trump juggernaut, put one in his locker, and then some reporters saw it. They asked him about it, and I guess naively, unthinkingly, whatever. I mean, he said, oh, yeah, Donald's great. I judged one of his beauty pageants, and we golfed together. And all of a sudden he was linked with Donald Trump. And Trump, who I actually happened to be writing about at the time, was just dropping his name like left and right and center and trying to accrue the goodwill that Tom Brady and Robert Kraft and eventually Bill Belichick have around New England to his own brand. And anyway, yeah, so I think Brady eventually wanted to just run in the other direction.
And Kraft and Trump, we saw the picture of Kraft with an open collar mm-hmm. going up the gold elevators, you know, a couple days after the election. We saw him at the infamous dinner in Mar-a-Lago with
Shinzo Abe.
Right, exactly, yes. Japanese prime minister. Is this affection, maybe too strong a word, but I'll use it. Is the affection substantively based, or is it sycophancy or accessibility based?
It's a great question. I would say it is, first of all, it's a level of wealth and fame and just sort of privileged class that I could not even begin to understand. I mean, part of it is like you see people who are kind of famous, kind of successful, and they're here. But, I mean, this is just, there's a club. Like, there's a club here, there's a club here, and then there's a club here. Right, and
he's putting his hands way over his head for those not watching on television.
This is like way up. It's a way up in wealth. I mean, I don't know if they have meaningful conversations about meaningful things and ideas and confidences are exchanged. But I could not begin to understand. We couldn't, and so you do get into the stratosphere where it's just different.
Yeah, and that whole. I mean, even though all those NFL owners are not necessarily that famous. I mean, I certainly don't know them. I saw the pictures of them, some of them in your book. But they're in that wealth stratosphere as well.
It's more than wealth, though. It's like you just like they – look, Donald Trump loves dropping Tom Brady's name and Robert Kraft's name and vice versa. Like by way of their – I'm raising my hands again. Their mutual like name dropping sort of brings flattery upon the two of them. There's like a mutual
– Yeah.
Can you say math? Kind of thing on this?
No, you can't.
Yes, you can.
Okay.
It's public.
It's a very clinical term. Yeah. But no, I think there's a lot of that going on.
But they're also, obviously, I mean, you talk obviously a lot about Bill Belichick in this book, but he bought the Trump thing as well because he wrote that letter.
Yeah, that was interesting. I read that, right? Saw that, you know, Trump was reading this letter from Belichick, and I was like, that doesn't sound like how Bill Belichick talks. I wonder if he either is making this up
That's
or if Belichick was just, you know, Belichick, I mean, he does. I don't know what he does in his spare time. Is he? Did he know he was going to do this? Because this is sort of what Donald Trump does. He is not shy about going public with private conversations or conversations that the other person didn't intend to make public. So, but eventually, yeah. I mean, Belichick didn't deny it. I think he wanted the distraction to go away. But I mean, that was that. You know, strange episode during that period.
You know, it may be unfair, but I'll ask anyway, and then you can tell me if you want to break it down a bit. Yeah. We're talking to Mark Leibovich. His book is Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Can you describe the owners as a class? And I know not everybody fits the mold you'll describe, but can you describe them as a class?
A club, maybe a class. Sure. I mean, I think class sort of implies that they actually have more class than they have. it's a different meaning of the class. I mean, a lot of these people are just fairly smaller than life and not that impressive group. But I mean, they're to get into the NFL is huge. Like people, like really, really rich, really, really prominent people in this country have been trying to get teams and they don't
like
open
Donald
up,
Trump, for
like
example.
Donald Trump over
and they wouldn't
decades.
Let him in.
They wouldn't let him in.
Why?
Most of them thought he was a clown. Most of them, well, first of all, there's history around the USFL, the United States Football League, which Donald Trump was one of the major domos in starting. He owned the New Jersey Generals. He ultimately was pretty responsible for putting them out of business and folding the league because he wanted to move them to the fall to compete with the NFL. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it didn't go well. There was a lawsuit, a lot of ugly history. But no, I mean, they, like a lot of people in business in that wealth stratosphere, they have dealt with him and they, you know, didn't want to be his business partner.
So. And you don't think much of Roger Goodell. I suppose that isn't that unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I think the owners seem to think a lot of him because he makes them a lot of money. No, I interviewed the commissioner a couple times. He's not a bad guy. He's just not. He's just a very nervous interview. It's a terrible interview. But he's also, it doesn't strike me as like someone who should be the CEO of a major cultural and entertainment juggernaut in this country.
You know, maybe this is naive because I don't travel in those circles either, and I don't know many people in that sort of world. But when you step, when one steps back and looks at what I consider to be the brilliance and simplicity of Trump's repeated throwing red meat to his base,
yeah.
His white base, about those black NFL players that have the audacity to disgrace their country and the flag or whatever other horrible thing they do. It is so simple, but you say to yourself, when billionaire successful business people fall for it, hook, line, and sinker, well, maybe Trump is not as clueless as some of us think he is. It works brilliantly, doesn't it?
He would say that this is
he
a
being Trump.
He would say, he being Trump, that this is a political winner for him. That it is very look, I mean, his base likes it. You know, if you look at polls, maybe 55% of people who watch NFL games think the players should be standing. It's an issue he understands. It's not that complicated. It puts him in the middle of this great spectacle of American life, which is pro football. And so it kind of has everything. There's also personal grievance involved because he doesn't, you know, he loves messing with this club that wouldn't have him as a member.
But it only works, Mark, doesn't it? Because the owners are so scared. And so, there's a new owner, I don't even know who he is, who bought a team this week or something from Carolina.
The Carolina Panthers.
Said,
yeah.
I honor the, you know, I respect the right of my players to protest. I would never stand in the way, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, David Tepper, I don't know the guy.
He
just came into the league. He just came into the league. But I mean, to me, that's a pretty bold statement for an NFL owner because most of them are going to cower. And I mean, I had the opportunity for this book to hear a tape of a secret tape of a group of owners and a group of players who were meeting at the height of the anthem crisis last October, and just to listen to, first of all, they were just talking over each other, and the players, they had a singular objective, which is, why isn't Colin Kaepernick, our brother, on the field? And the owners were like, yeah, we'll get to that, but that's not about this. Can you stop kneeling, and what's Donald going to do next? I mean, you have a sense of incredible short-sighted thinking among people who, you know, are in a very, you know, enviable position, who have all kinds of leverage, and yet they're just worried about this guy in the White House tweeting. I mean, think about the sentence I just said. Like, think of how, like, would that sentence, like, what would I, who would ever think a sentence like that would be uttered 5 years ago? I mean, that's the thing about the NFL. They're all afraid of, like, the next chandelier falling on their heads.
But that their fears seem to be legitimate in some sense because they're losing money. I don't know if they're losing money, but the ratings are not what they were.
I think that, like, a lot of consumers of politics, NFL owners are slowly seeing that Donald Trump has maybe reached a point of diminishing returns as far as him sort of going back to the same well, the same issue, the same tweets. Because a novelty does sort of wear off. I mean, you can only do this a few times. And I think he did make a dent in, I mean, he created all kinds of problems for them last year. He created all kinds of bad will among conservative fans. Many of NFL fans are quite conservative. Traditionally, it's been the liberals who have been more suspicious of the NFL, maybe for reasons of violence or over-the-top patriotism or militarism. And so, yeah, he's caused all kinds of friction in the culture around football. So that itself is difficult for them because they want a pretty easy life. They want to be sort of revered as kings of their communities. So, but I do think that look, I think I don't know how much longer Trump is going to have the ability to just sort of turn large sectors of the population around this business.
We're talking to Mark Leibovitz. The book is Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. I was anxious to talk to you because I've asked so many people this and you have insights that I certainly don't have. I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more of a revival this fall of the kneeling because of the idea that you're either going to stay in the locker room or not come out and kneel, and you're going to have the penalties and the big brouhaha. So the strength in numbers, right?
Yeah. Yes. But here's the thing. This is what's interesting to me, and that's a really good point, because last year I think players, for the first time in a long time, realized that they have a power that they didn't know. Because NFL players are exploited to a large degree as far as in pro sports, they don't have guaranteed contracts.
Yeah.
Their careers are really short.
Football, we're talking about.
Football
different
players.
Than the NBA.
Absolutely. Their careers are short. It's taking a huge physical toll. I mean, there's all kinds of things. And, but Colin Kaepernick and people who were kneeling after him or protesting afterwards were affecting the bottom line. Last week out in California, I was on Martellus Bennett's podcast. Martellus Bennett is a 11-year veteran. He played for the Patriots for a year. Really interesting guy. He retired from football last year and is now running an animation studio. He's doing all kinds of creative things. He's got this podcast that we're just sort of going back and forth for like an hour and a half. I don't know if they put the whole thing up there, but it just posted yesterday. But he was saying he raised his fist during the national anthem. He did when he was with the Patriots. I think he was one of a small number, maybe two or three. And then in Green Bay, I think he might have been the only player, one of two players who did when he played for the Packers last year. And he told me that a lot of the younger players, on sort of the roster bubble who had not made as much money as he had, who were not in a secure position, said they would like to do something too, but it's a terrible career move, as Colin Kaepernick, as Eric Reid, as any number of other players could attest to. So Martellus would say to them, look, I'll just do it so you don't have to. But you do get a sense. He said that if people had guaranteed contracts, if there was more security for players, you would see a lot more, expression of that.
Mark Leibovitz, can we talk about the other world in which you spend most of your time? Use the expression short-sighted thinking a second ago. Chuck Todd was with us at 11 o'clock, and I don't want to put words in Chuck's mouth, but I think Chuck would say, or Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, he was talking about the short-sighted thinking of the Republicans if they decide on a straight party line vote with 50 or 51 of them, 50 plus Pence or 51, approving. He made a point, which I never thought about, is there's never been a Supreme Court nominee who's been approved with not one vote from
is
the other party. And we double-checked it's true. What's your – we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if there's going to be a hearing. We don't know if Professor Ford's going to show up. What's your sense of the potential impact on the midterms if the Republicans decide to just slam this baby through – even if there's no FBI investigation and no appearance by Ford?
Yeah, I think, that's a tough one. I do think you could go either way on this. You could say the Republican base would be so furious that they would punish whoever the Republicans are, if there are Republicans.
If they vote, if
like Collins or Murkowski, Flake, someone, decides to just sort of, step out. That could be a big sort of drain on the base. Women voters. I mean, the Democratic base is so energized to begin with. The question is, and someone said this to me yesterday, how much more energized can they get? I mean, if you need another, an Anita Hill happening, in a much more woke environment in which, women are already energized to a degree that they haven't been in a long, long time, if ever, you could just be making things worse in the midterms. Although I don't know. Look, I mean, when you think of like short-term thinking, and the other, it's like collective thinking. I mean, this is parochial thinking. I mean, Heidi Heitkamp, Jeff, well, actually not Jeff Flake, he's not running for re-election. Susan Collins. I mean, their number one concern, maybe not Claire McCaskill, she's already come out in one way or the other, is self-perpetuation. There is a big and sort of complicated, consideration that a Joe Manchin is going to make. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, I think these swing Democrats are probably more important at this point, because if they can hold serve, who knows? But I don't know. I mean, I think that would require looking at the big picture that most individual lawmakers don't usually entertain.
We're talking to Mark Leavitt. The book is Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. You had a great magazine piece in the New York Times a few years ago about Donald Trump before he was President Trump, obviously. And there's a great section which we just, we printed it out. I sound like I'm 110.
Was it mimeograph?
Mimeograph. I wrote it out in a long
carbon paper.
That's right.
On carbon paper, right.
About his concern about you're washing your hands when you were on the plane with him.
Yeah, he's a germaphobe.
Yeah, tell us about this and the shrimp and the...
No, he was a...
It's like a Seinfeld
It's a Seinfeld
stick,
thing. No,
it
sort of was. Like, we were on this plane, we were on his campaign plane, or his plane, that was his campaign plane. We were leaving Dallas. He was... So it was funny, because it was me and him and Hope Hicks in the front of the plane, and he was watching a couple of TVs in which he was flipping around to see how the news was covering the rally he had just done in Dallas. And then a staff of 20, many of them security people, logistics people, who were in a compartment in the plane. I mean, the food was sort of brought past them, but none of them could move until the Donald was ready to eat. So he invited me to the back cabin where this really good Texas restaurant, you know, had catered, or I think Dallas restaurant had catered, like this great, these large tins of food. And there was a shrimp component to this. And I think, yes, he invited me to wash my hands, which I assume meant that he wanted me to wash my hands. He had already washed his hands. I mean, his cleanliness and his obsession with that is well documented. But the thing that people really took from that story, and this was like a 7,000-word story, but I probably got more comments on what I'm about to say than the following. He warned me that I should not double dip the shrimp. Because there was like some kind of cocktail sauce, and I had shrimp, and I think it was more of a... I think he wanted to make sure that I took a portion of the cocktail sauce onto my plate so that the dipping would take place in a contained area and not in the common cocktail sauce.
Did you have courage to stand up to him, or you just were cowed?
No. I wanted to be respectful. I was a guest on his plane. But he then told me a story about a guy who was 300 pounds. The offender at some party like had just done a terrible triple dip or something, and he felt his weight was like relevant. But he was like very animated about this. And look, he was very... I would not want to insult him.
Do you know, because I have always wondered, he does have to shake people's hands when he's out on the trail. So does he do the Purell thing? Do we have any
idea? It's funny. I don't remember him using Purell.
Yeah, I've never seen
it
either.
Although a lot of politicians, they swear by that
Yeah,
stuff.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, if you're shaking hands of hundreds of people a day, somebody might have a cold.
I think
reasonable.
Purell is a little bit, I think he's just into more just old school hand washing.
Yeah, old school hand washing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Mark, it's great to see you.
Great to see you.
Another
guys.
Great,
one
great
more
book.
Yeah. One more thing before you go. I just want to know about Brady and his having absolutely no hobbies. That's just it. Totally disciplined. It's all about giving up your life for football.
It is, yeah.
And
I mean, see, I've tried that too, but it doesn't work. I mean,
but he's got the health business.
He's got the health business. Now, look, I think that might be changing a little bit. He seems to have, maybe tried to step a little bit away from football in the last offseason.
And he's talked about his joylessness with Belichick, maybe even
he hasn't explicitly said that. Well, yeah, that's like, there's a new book on Belichick by a guy named Ian O'Connor of ESPN that sounds like it sort of pushes that story along. Now, look, like any marriage that long is going to have strains, and I think clearly they're sick of each other, but they're also stuck with each other, and while they're together, they might as well try to win football games, and I'm all for it.
Although a lot of men might say if they were married to Giselle a bunch and they could overcome whatever strains there might be.
It's a different kind of marriage, though. It's like, it's like a football marriage. It's like, with the coach and...
Oh, okay. Okay.
This is getting really deep. No, Anyway, by the way, it's good to be in a place where I don't have to apologize for being a Patriots fan. Because I was on the West Coast last week and I say, hey, Mark's a Patriots fan.
I'm from Philadelphia, my friend. So
you
be
an
careful.
Fan?
I am an Eagles fan.
You know what? Congratulations.
Thank
and
you.
In New York City, you have to go to specific Patriots.
Well, I live in Washington.
Oh, you live in Washington. Okay. Yeah. So I know in New York, you have to go to specific Patriots bars, right?
No, you can just – that's the thing. I actually made the decision I'm not going to give the NFL any more of my money because the Patriots in Washington where I live are usually – if there's a big game, it's on TV. It's on free TV. I mean, they're national enough. The playoffs will always be on. And if I really want to watch the game, I'll go to a bar. Or not. But I don't want to give the NFL money.
Well, I'm going to say congratulations again. Like I said, I don't know who's got more good gossip, you or Bob Woodward in his book about
You know what? I will be signing copies of my book tonight and also Woodward's book if you want me to do that.
Yes, you will. You'll be signing them at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 o'clock. Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. The book, Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times, Harvard Bookstore, 7 o'clock. Thank you so much.
And by the way, you know what gives people an opportunity to figure out? He will be at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
You know where he will also be at exactly 7 o'clock?
Greater Boston with Jim Browdy.
And you guys have to figure out how he did that. Isn't that amazing?
It's unbelievable, amazing.
The bookstore event could be tape delayed.
Coming up, we're getting Uncorked we'll with Jonathan Austin with the Boston Wine School. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last time, Jonathan Alsop, founder of the Boston Wine School, was here. We just celebrated what was then the latest study on drinking. This is right. That middle-aged moderate drinkers were less likely to get dementia. And to prove the point, I actually remember that we talked about it. But what is there to celebrate off the latest research on alcohol when it comes to drinking zero alcohol being the only healthy amount? He joins us to talk about this and a whole variety of other related things. He's the author of The Wine Lover's Devotional. Jonathan Alsop, nice to see you.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. How
Hello,
are you?
Hello, Jonathan Alsop. So great to see you. So we want to talk about some stories that could really affect your business. The first one is the thing that Jim just mentioned. This is the alcohol. We don't know if it's safe in any amount at all. I mean, do you think this impacts what you do?
You know, I think, first of all, we have to be really, really realistic about this.
Yes.
Ethanol has been great to me. ethanol has given me something to write about. Ethanol has given me something to teach about. Ethanol has enriched my life spectacularly. Our family just lost a member of our family to alcohol.
Oh.
Okay?
Sorry.
So as far as I am on this end of the spectrum of the wine life being very good for me, my cousin Jeffrey, that wasn't his fate and that wasn't his life.
Oh, dear.
And we need to be super, super realistic about this and not, you know, when you read wine magazines, when you talk to wine people, it's relentlessly positive. And, you know, I'm from Ohio. I have a relentlessly, irrationally positive mental attitude about everything.
Yeah.
But I think when it comes to this, you know, we return to some basic concepts of moderation, some concepts of wine as food, you know, versus wine as booze.
Yeah.
I don't know how to solve this. I don't know how to think about it. I mean, in medical terms, it's true. There's no way to assess a safe quantity of ethanol in your diet. So I think scientifically and medically, you have to say there is no recommended quantity from a technical perspective.
But it is one of the great pleasures, is it not, to go out for dinner with friends and to have a wonderful glass of wine.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, if you're having seven glasses of wine, then you've got something that you may have to consider, but. Most
well, see, I think it's not just the competing studies that, you know, this literally last time you were here, we had a major study that was different from the one now. But I can't imagine somebody, I hate to be anti-science because I'm not, can't imagine the profile of the person who was a moderate drinker who says, I now read the study that there's no amount of alcohol that's safe. And by the way,
and
that takes into account things like
drink at all.
I'm not going to drink at all.
Yeah.
So, but one thing that would worry me if I were in your business is marijuana.
Yes.
There's a story I read where there's they talk about the limited inebriation dollar, and what
I love that expression.
And I love that.
And for those who haven't figured out what that means, it means there's only so much available dough you have to spread around between intoxicants, either wine or beer or hard liquor or marijuana.
Right.
And obviously, it's becoming more and more legal. Ultimately, I mean, the national polls are overwhelming. Ultimately, when Jeff Sessions is gone, it's probably going to be legal nationally. That is a threat to the wine industry, is it not?
Well, you know, it's being perceived as a threat, and people are worried about it, and people are saying, hey, you know, is this, as you say, you have only so much disposable income. You've got, you know, X quantity of buzz that you're determined to put on. you know, it's kind of a zero-sum game in some ways. And there is this fear that these different intoxicants are going to take away from other markets. I mean, this is something when I think back, you know, I'm 102 now. You know, when I think back to the emergence of cassette tapes and 8-track and VHS, remember how these were going to destroy media and
they were
going to destroy.
Yeah.
The fact is that people who make, you know, people who are into these different intoxicants are into them in a big way. So that to try to think that, you know, to think that you're gonna section one off and have it not affect another is just, I don't know. I'm not feeling as threatened by it, personally. If anything, I see educational opportunities, for what people don't know about.
Well, you
cannabis.
Know what we should do? Then we should celebrate the fact that you're not threatened. What are we drinking here today? What's the first wine of choice?
Okay, so I brought a couple of reds on Monday, October 8th, Columbus Day. Mm-hmm. We're doing a class at Boston Public Market. You know, wine people think that wine solves everything. So I've tried to find two wines that relate to, in some positive way, with Christopher Columbus in First Contact. So the first wine that we're tasting, this is a Barbera from northwestern Italy. Columbus was from Genoa in northwestern Italy. And this is a Barbera di Asti. And Asti is a little town about 50 miles north of where Columbus grew up.
It's delicious.
You're liking that?
Yes, I am.
Yeah,
I'm not even a big red
it's
wine
my,
person.
Well, I am, and this is my kind of red
wine. Well,
the
grape is called Barbera, and it's kind of. I mean, you guys tell me what you think, but it's a big wine, but it's also kind of soft, right? Some red wines can be a little overwhelming.
Do you think it's big and soft, Marjorie?
Mm. I think it's not a heavy, thick wine,
right?
Which puts me to sleep,
right?
In about 2 seconds.
So
luckily, it's not that kind of wine.
How much does that run? And by the way, on your Facebook page, you list these, right?
Well, so at bostonwineschool.com/Boston Public Radio.
Oh, okay.
I'm slowly but surely accumulating all of the wine that we've tasted online. So if people want to order them, if people want to read about them, if people want to find out more, bostonwineschool.com/Boston Public Radio.
How much does this set you back?
22.
Mm-hmm.
$22.
Red wine's more of a fall winter drink.
Well, and that's another thing that's happening now. We're starting to really transition people's eating habits are transitioning with the weather.
Yeah, white wine seems bad in cold weather.
What's the other one?
So Columbus was from Italy. It was the Spanish monarchs who paid for his trip.
Ooh, a Spanish
to
wine. You
the
are
US.
So creative.
So I'm trying.
Okay, what do you got here?
So this is a Rioja, Pagos de Tojola.
This is
Rioja. This is the signature. Ooh. This is the signature grape of Spain. You know, it was the Spanish monarchs that paid the bill. Some of the money had to come from the wines of Rioja. We know this. I mean, this is the most, even if you don't know anything about wine, even if you don't know anything about Spanish wine, you've heard of Rioja. And
you like this one?
Better.
How do you describe this one? Go ahead.
Speak from your heart.
Exactly. Speak from your heart.
Well, it's lighter red. Mm-hmm. And as someone who doesn't like heavy wines, red wines, this is the lighter one. And it just has a nice taste and aftertaste.
Ooh.
Aftertaste is key, Jim. I've always found in my wine excursions.
Yeah. What's this one called again?
Look at John,
So this is Rioja, and this is the winery is called Pagos de Tojola. And
how much is that one?
This one's 27.
You know, have you been reading about, I'm sure this is anathema to you, even though you're so upbeat today, I don't know what's wrong with you. I've been reading about these things that people go alcohol-free for a month. I love the expression.
I know.
Go sober for October sober for is what October. Some people. But the thing I don't understand about, this is not an alcoholics thing. It's basically, it sounds like it's a cleanse one system thing.
Yes.
But I know you're not a scientist, but the sense, I've read a few articles about this. If it turns out the month of abstinence sort of undid whatever the negative effects of drinking are, then I would say, well, do it for a month.
Right.
But everything I've read suggests that for the month, you avoid all the negative impacts, but it has no spillover from what happened before or after. Is that your understanding?
Well, yes. This is the issue with this, that within, sober October or wine-free January or whatever you want to pick, you do have some benefits, reduced blood pressure, blood sugar, a lot of positive impacts to a person's individual blood sugar. But, the thing is, if on November 1, you immediately go back to your previous behavior, there's no long-term benefit. You're just taking a little break. You're taking a little break from that.
Yeah, moderation.
Jim, what month of the year is it when you shave your head?
I don't shave. I come close to shaving. It's the thing that's done.
Right.
That is done by a corporate leader who does wonderful things. Granite Telecommunications in Quincy.
Well, let's do this. Let's try and do this together next time. You shave your head. I'll go alcohol free. I'm not.
Oh, you mean the same deal?
I'm not doing this for nothing. Okay.
But the difference
this
is
gotta,
the head of the
some
company
kind of, some kind of positive.
Delivers it donates $50,000 if you shave your head.
Right.
Who's going to donate anything if you don't drink?
I don't know. I'm just trying to make this thing.
Yeah,
work.
He needs a cause. He needs a cause. Hey, we're in this terrible situation down in North Carolina. It's when the floods are just ending. But we've also had these terrible situations in wine country where the drought is really impacting wine growing. So what is the forecast for this increased threat from climate
And we're running
disruption?
Low on time.
Sure.
Yeah.
So one of the issues with this is that this notion of more sun, more heat, better growing conditions are going to be bad for wine. It's a little bit counterintuitive because on the one hand, it's going to be great for grapes. You're going to get riper grapes. You're going to get a bigger crop. From an agricultural perspective, global warming is not necessarily bad for grapes, but it can be bad for wine downstream because it throws off the whole sugar and acid balance of the grape. And that ends up giving you unrealistic tasting wines downstream.
So we shouldn't worry too much yet, is the bottom line.
It's starting. The Sahara has already jumped the Mediterranean. So I think it's time you should start worrying.
One more time, if people want to check these wines out, where do they go?
BostonWineSchool.com/Boston Public Radio.
Jonathan, thanks as always.
Is where
Thank
Jonathan
you,
is from,
Thank
the
you,
Boston
Marjorie.
Wine School. Thank you. He's also the author of the Wine Lover's Devotional. To learn more about Boston Wine School, go to BostonWineSchool.org. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can always find us by way of our podcast and iTunes. Tomorrow, I'm really excited, live at the Boston Public Library. We're going to be joined by actor and director Ethan Hawke, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's got a new book out, plus our Friday news quiz. What's on television, please, Jim Brady?
Well, Mark Leibovich is going to continue the conversation with me. The guy who used to be the CEO of Dunkin' Donuts, who is now the chair of the board, has written a terrific book about management, enlightened management in America. He's going to join me. And last week I had Livingston Taylor, whom I love. His niece, who you met a couple of months ago, Sally Taylor, has got
great.
A wonderful exhibit. Well, a wonderful thing she's got going in Western Massachusetts. Sally Taylor is joining me tonight, so I'm going to talk to her as well. And by the way, it's not BostonWineSchool.org. It's BostonWineSchool.com. Am I not right?
.com.
Thank you very much.
My apologies, Jonathan. Thanks to our crew. Thank you for listening. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Brady.
Have
See you at the library.
Have a great afternoon, and hope you can come to the library.